on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Perry from the 92nd Legislative District here in Pennsylvania about his English-only bill, House Bill 888, where we're going to make Pennsylvania an English-only state. And the wonders of open welcome arms, what that's going to mean, why he's doing this, what the point is. That'll be an interesting conversation. Also, we're going to talk with Dustin Slaughter, activist, filmmaker from the Philadelphia area. Currently, he is in New York at the Wall Street protests. Saturday was the day of rage. Some 5,000 people came out to protest Wall Street and really the greed class. I mean, you cannot possibly look at what's going on Wall Street and say that's the way you want to run an economy, where the people who are making billions of dollars are paying less taxes than the people who are cleaning the floors. A problem there. Now, the right, they'll argue, well, you know, the guy cleaning the floors, he should be paying less taxes. And they go, well, you know, if you make that argument, who is then going to provide for schools and military and roads and bridges and do all the things that we need, that we know we need to do? And we're going to talk about transportation today, too, because getting out of New York City was an absolute nightmare. And anybody who tells me that we don't have serious infrastructure problems in this country has really never been to New York City or tried to get the hell out of New York City. And in the third hour, we're going to talk with Adam Weinstein. He's the national security reporter over at Mother Jones Magazine. Going to be talking about the GI Bill and the rise of these for-profit colleges and the amount, just the obscene amount of taxpayer dollars going to these for-profit universities and colleges who are paying just mind-blowing CEO salaries. You know, they were talking about the guy from Penn State. I think he makes, what, about $800,000 a year, maybe $1 million? These guys are taking $10, $20, $30 million. And you don't hear the same kind of outrage. You don't hear the same kind of anger that I would expect. And I think a big part of it is most people don't know. It's one of those things that has gone under the current. It's something that they've done a very nice job of keeping that whole for-profit status, you know, kind of under the covers. But we all know who they are. Kaplan, DeVry, ITT, University of Phoenix. Big money. And we're going to talk about that with Adam Weinstein. Also, your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the big news today, class warfare. I guess, you know, the Republicans now think that there's class warfare going on and we need to fight back against the president. And personally, I got to be honest, it's about damn time somebody realized there's class warfare going on in this country besides Warren Buffett. It's about time that the people who are getting screwed stand up and say no more, which is why I'm happy to see the people in New York. And we were there for a little bit on Sunday with my daughter and I. And, you know, it's I think there should be tens of thousands of people out there. We should all have a moment of anger. We should all be marching on our capitals. But that's going to take some more organization. So today the president outlined his plan to trim some deficits and adding this thing he's calling the Buffett rule. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, Warren Buffett in the past. The reality is we want to ensure that people making over $1 million a year, you know what? They pay at least as high as the tax rate that the people that work for them. The president said that middle-class families shouldn't pay higher taxes than millionaires and billionaires. That's pretty straightforward. It's hard to argue against that, he said. Warren Buffett's secretary shouldn't pay a higher tax rate than Warren Buffett. There's just no justification for it, he said. He goes on to say anyone who says we can't change the tax code to correct that, anyone who has signed some pledge to protect every single tax loophole, so long as they live, they should be called out, and they should have to defend that unfairness. And I love his attack on the pledges. He says if their pledge is to keep that kind of unfairness in place, they should remember. The last time I checked, the president said, the only pledge that really matters is the pledge we make to uphold the Constitution. So it's a nice shot at these people who have taken Norquist's anti-tax pledge. And so now he comes out with this, and all the same suspects, all the usual defenders, all the people out there defending the loopholes, defending the big oil and gas companies out there doing their thing, saying, oh, this is just class warfare. And the president came out and said, look, you know, the reality is I reject the idea that asking a hedge fund manager to pay the same tax rates as a plumber or a teacher is class warfare. He says, I think it's just the right thing to do. And he went on to say, this is not class warfare. It's math. So, you know, when I thought of this, I saw this and I go, well, you know, it's not class warfare. It's math. There's going to be a war on math next. Understand, you know, they're going to fight the numbers. If they can't fudge them, they will fight them. And you saw right away, almost within minutes, Paul Ryan was out there offering the same tired lines. The president's engaging in class warfare. He says, you know, we can't divide people. We can't prey on people's fear. We can't prey on their envy and anxiety. And I'm going, really? Isn't that Republican 101? Is that what you learned on the first day when you got your little GOP badge? And you're like, great, to a extent, we need a system that creates jobs and innovation. You said in November of 2010, you were that guy. Your party was going to create jobs, and you were going to create jobs, and you were going to create jobs. I remember 1, 2, and 3, jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet we haven't seen anything, nothing. All we've seen is the same tired policy that got us into the mess we're in right now. So he attacked the Buffett rule. Say, oh, you know, well, they pay their taxes. And I said, really? You know, Buffett's a billionaire. He's the guy who says, you know, when I do my taxes, and he doesn't do any loopholing. He doesn't look for deductions that aren't obviously apparent to someone who files the easy form. And he pays a lower effective tax rate than his secretary does. And I'm struck by this whole argument that, oh, you're engaging in class warfare, and that it's simply going to divide the country more. Really? Can we get much more divided? I think this is a unifying thing. I think finally the working class of this country goes, you know, this is what we've been talking about, taxed enough already here, right here in the middle class. Those of us who swing a hammer and clean the offices, taxed enough. But we still need schools, and we still need roads, and we still need bridges, and we still need a military, and we still need a police department, and we still need all these things. Somebody's got to pay for it. And the people who pay for it are the people who have all the money. And this isn't dividing people. This is saying there are some people who have the resources to be able to afford it, and there are people who don't. That's reality. But, you know, now we're being looked at as, how dare you ask the wealth class for more? How dare you? They're the job creators. And the reality is they're not creating jobs. And they're not going to create jobs. Fact of the matter is they're sitting on trillions of dollars. Oh, but I know. They're uncertain. No, what they're doing is they're buying back all of their assets. They're setting themselves up for the future. So I look at what the president did today, and I add this to his proposed $447 billion job plan, and I say, you know what, maybe this guy's growing a backbone after all. Maybe there's some spine in there after all. Maybe a steel rod was implanted in his last vacation. I don't know. So this is, to me, a good thing. But what I find interesting is the Republicans are all, you know, they're worried about the job craters. Worried about the and these mythical job craters. You know, they're out there. We probably driving around with the welfare queen and the family farmer who lost his farm because of the estate tax. Probably cruising around together. But they're worried about this mythical job crater. What about the job destroyers? What about the people who deliberately destroy jobs? I look at Merck, the CEO there, their big head guy there, Richard Clark. Pocketed almost $18 million last year. Then they announced they're gonna kick to the curb some 13,000 workers. And when he kicked those 13,000 people to the curb, guess what happened to his pocket? Got heavier. A little bit more in there. Look at Brian Moynihan, the guy from Bank of America. He pulled in a cool $10 million last year. They just announced 30,000 new job cuts. What are we gonna do? What are we gonna do there? Those are the job destroyers. How do you fix that? Oh, you don't. That's right. Because we have a perverted system. And the system is that the more you can shed costs, the more the CEOs make. So if you don't have a tax rate that's going to say, you know what, we're going to bring some of that down, you're just encouraging more of the same behavior. Just a thought. And I look at this representative from Louisiana, this John Fleming. Again, another one of these extraordinarily wealthy people who sits in our Congress. Now, Mr. Fleming, he owns, and good for him. I mean, you know, you got to give the guy credit. He has done business-wise all the right things. He owns 33 Subway restaurants, the little sandwich shops. He owns a number of the UPS store chains that you see. He owns them in Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, a whole bunch of them. You know, to be honest, I wonder where he'll be on the Postal Service when that comes up, owning UPS stores, but that's a whole other thing. I look at what he was on MSNBC with Chris Jansen, and I guess I just have to play the clip because, you know, they're talking about, you know, him having money, and they're talking about, you know, what happens with his business, and he made a whole bunch of money, and he, listen to his clip.
Since my net income, and again, that's the individual rate that I told you about, the amount that I have to reinvest in my business and feed my family is more like $600,000 of that $6.3 million. And so by the time I feed my family, I have, you know, maybe $400,000 left over.
So, you know, he's making the argument that, you know, his business takes in about $6.3 million a year. And he pays his employees, which he should. You know, he pays all his bills. And then he's got about $600 left to feed his family. So after he feeds his family, which, you know, $200,000, you kind of got to wonder about, he's got $400,000 left over. And he's trying to make the argument that, you know, he just can't afford one more penny of taxation. Just can't afford it. It's just not there. Sorry. And trying to make the whole argument. And then the woman, you got to give her credit, this Chris Jansen, she says, look, do you get the fact that people are struggling? Do you get the fact that they're broke? And he seemed, you know, in watching the clip, he seemed to be not there. And I find it quite interesting. So as I look through this whole thing, and you got to give the president credit, I don't think what he's laid out doesn't stand a snowball's chance of passing, but it's worth having the discussion. And this is something Republicans have been very, very good at over the years. They cast a wide net. They give you their wish list. They put everything on there. They just seem to be better negotiators. They throw more demands on the table, more outrageous demands on the table as well. But in turn, they get many more of those than the Democrats ever do. I just think Democrats are just bad at negotiating, it must be. Maybe we should put a couple of union people on those negotiating committees. Maybe then we'd get something. But it is what it is. So we're going to be talking about this today, the tax issue, the president's speech today, my trip to New York. And when we come back, we're going to talk about this English-only thing like we talked about last week. But I've got State Representative Scott Perry, one of the sponsors of one of the bills, House Bill 888. He's going to be here talking about this. And maybe we can get him to talk about a couple other things. We'll do that. So we're going to take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back with Representative Scott Perry.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On Thursday, the House passed what's been called by opponents the Outsourcers' Bill of Rights. H.R. 2587 hobbles the power of not just the National Labor Relations Board, but also the courts, when it comes to acting punitively against companies that perform illegally. According to a statement signed by more than 100 professors who analyzed the legislation, the bill eliminates any meaningful remedy for an employer's refusal to bargain with a union in circumstances where it's required to do so before transferring or contracting out work. California Representative George Miller spoke passionately from the floor against the legislation, which went on to pass with a vote of 238 to 186.
This bill is really about working Americans all across this country, and they should pay very careful attention to this bill and to this debate, because it affects their livelihood, their ability to support their families, the safety of their jobs at work, the conditions under which they work, and their ability to participate in their increased productivity in higher wages and better conditions. This bill takes the rights away from workers, from all workers, all across the country. This isn't just about whether you belong to a union or not. This is about whether or not your employer can retaliate against you by taking your work away, by sending your work down the road or out of the country.
What's the real monstrous lie about Social Security? Doug Cunningham explains.
Don't believe the big lie that Social Security is teetering on bankruptcy and won't be there for future generations. It's a monstrous lie about Social Security. A new Social Security issue brief from the Center on Economic and Policy Research says that even if no further changes are made to the program, Social Security remains fully solvent through 2038. Recognizing the fact that Social Security is in no danger of failing, President Obama is leaving it out of his new deficit reduction proposal. Social Security in no way contributes to the deficit. For 77 years, it's paid for itself and generated huge surpluses. All that needs to happen to make sure Social Security is there for our elderly for another 77 years after 2038 is to require that Social Security taxes be paid on incomes above the current limit of $106,800 a year. That's according to an actuarial projection at socialsecurity.gov based on the Social Security Trustees 2010 report. If high-income folks pay the same Social Security tax as the rest of us, the program remains fully funded with no cuts in benefits. The big truth is that Social Security is rock solid, with only minor changes needed to fully fund it at current benefit levels for another 75 years.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm on a Mexican radio. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I remember a history teacher I had back in high school who responded to my disinterest in his class, telling me that I had better learn my history lessons, so that when I noticed them coming back around, I could see it. And like many things, he was spot on. He was a bright guy. The more things change, the more they seem to stay the same. And you look at the xenophobia that was created by the Know-Nothing Party of the 1840s and 1850s. That seems to be reemerging before our very eyes. Only this time, it's not the Germans and the Irish Catholics. It's the Latinos and the Indians. And I guess the one positive thing out of this is Pennsylvania seems to be right on the cutting edge of the movement, at least when you look at this English-only thing. That's why I have asked Scott Perry, Pennsylvania State Representative, and the sponsor of House Bill 888, to come talk to us. It's titled The Official Language Act. Representative Perry, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I'm looking at this, and I got the first question I've got is, who wrote House Bill 888?
Well, I and, you know, unfortunately, a bunch of lawyers on the staff that make sure it's in that that bill speak that legislation seems to come out in.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm looking at the two of them, Rosemary Schwanger's 361 and your 888, and they seem to be close.
Sure.
Almost identical.
Right. So she's got a provision, I think, that specifically enumerates the ability to sue whatever agency doesn't comport with or comply with the law if it were to be passed.
Okay.
So mine doesn't have that.
Let me ask you the big question. What are you trying to accomplish with this?
A little bit of unity, Rick. That's what I can't understand. I mean, xenophobia? Really? Do you think I have a fear or hatred? It's not about fear or hatred. Look, I'm trying. There's so much to be divisive about. Listen, whether I listen to talk radio during the day or the Rick Smith show at night, there's no end to the tripe just goes on and on about we hate this side or we hate that side. Tell me what is positive about our government promoting the divisions among us as opposed to the one thing that should unite us.
Well, it's not about dividing us. It's about being welcoming to those folks that we've welcomed into our country.
We're not saying you're not welcome. There's nobody saying you're, as a matter of fact, we're saying please come.
But those
please
people
come.
who are struggling to learn the language, you are now saying that your government is not going to be a helping hand in this.
Let me ask you this, Rick. Do you believe that citizens and people that come here should obey the law?
Absolutely.
So do you know that it's an immigration policy that if you're going to become a naturalized American citizen, you have to have a functional knowledge of English? So who am I harming?
And I'm in favor of people learning English. I'm against the idea of having this kind of hostile environment because I don't see the point in it. There are so many things that are going on right now. There are so many people unemployed. There are so many people losing their homes that we're now talking about something that, in my opinion, you seem to think this is going to unite us. I think this divides us.
Well, listen, this isn't the only thing that's going to unite us, first of all. Number two, I don't necessarily disagree with you regarding the priorities. We've got a lot on our plate, and there are a lot of bigger issues, arguably, than this one. But this is nothing new, Rick. As you know, it already passed the House once in 2006, and I introduced it in 2007, and it's just been sitting out there waiting for somebody to have a hearing on it, and that's what happened. The State Government Committee had a hearing, and now everybody's up in arms like this is some kind of new epiphany. It's not. But at the same time, people say, well, you know, Perry, you talk about cutting the budget and you talk about cutting government. Well, where, you know, give us some ideas. Listen, nobody even keeps track of how much money we're spending. I just ran the numbers on what we spend in education, which, by the way, is growing exponentially for English language learners and English as a second language in Pennsylvania and across the nation. And I come up with $200 to $500 million annually just for that, and it's growing. You know, people's property taxes are going up, and they wonder, you know, what's driving it. And one of the things that's driving it is this. Why not promote something? We're not saying we don't want you to learn English. We absolutely want you to learn English. Why don't we do something to promote that?
Well, I'm in favor of promoting helping people. What you're talking about is $200 to $500 million, the number you've thrown out there, is for programs to help people learn English and to help them assimilate into society. So where is that money going to go, and where is it going to come from to help them learn the language
first
down the road?
First of all, Rick, this legislation does nothing to imperil or impede that money. What we're trying to do over time is reduce the need for it. People used to come here and they taught in their homes so that when your child showed up at first grade, had some functional knowledge of English. Now they're showing up in fifth grade and they have no clue.
Well, I mean, that's a whole other social problem that we have to deal with.
But
this going to change that?
And our government rules are promoting it. We have various agencies that print things in foreign language and distribute government information in a myriad of different languages. How is that promoting it? Number one. Number two, aren't we leaving ourselves up for criticism of being discriminatory? Whether, you know, some agencies print in Japanese and Spanish and some only in English, or some in Russian and three other languages and the next one only in English. I mean, where's the fairness there?
But with today's technology, we're not talking about something that's an obstacle so great that we can't accomplish it.
Well,
you brought up something a second ago that I absolutely agree with. This is not a new issue. When I've done some reading on labor history, you know, most of my life. And the reason I brought up the know-nothing era is, you know, that's what it came out of, this whole English-only fight of the 1830s and the 1840s. This is not a new issue. We're not reinventing the wheel. These are the same arguments that we've been hearing for years. And at the end of the day, English is still the predominant language. You're talking about a very small number of people who, for a very short period of time, hold on to their language, because English, I don't know if you know, is a kind of a difficult language to learn.
Yeah, there's about probably upward of 300,000 different English words compared to other languages that maybe have 30,000. Yeah, but doesn't mean you have to use all 300,000 up there to maybe 400,000. You don't have to, but it's a beautiful language, and it is the language of our culture. And again, it's the one thing that binds us all together among all our differences.
And eventually, you know, here's the thing. I had friends growing up, you know, whose parents were first generation.
Yeah.
And they spoke very little broken English. The second generation, the kids that I were friendly with, they spoke both languages frequently. I now know that their children don't speak the home language at all.
Yeah.
It's the assimilation process. So what frightens me, and this is, you know, this is more to the point. What frightens me is the venom that's being whipped up in all this. The xenophobia, the you know, this hatred that this whole thing is whipping up. I'm just not.
But Rick, who's whipping up the venom? Certainly it's not me. First of all, I come from a Hispanic family, and I'm exactly what you spoke about. You know, my mother speaks Spanish fluently, but I speak barely any Spanish because she wouldn't teach it to me. She said, you're American, you're going to learn English, and that's how you're going to be productive and prosperous and successful, not by speaking Spanish. But what we're finding, if you look at the demographics, is that is no longer the case in America, where the first generation spoke very little, the next generation spoke predominantly, and finally the third generation didn't speak any of the native language of the forefathers. That's not what we're seeing. The demographic is changing. And how are we going to maintain our culture? It's not about xenophobia. It's about maintaining who we are as Americans. And if the people say, well, you know, it can't go extinct, well, look at Canada and some of the provinces there. Are we going to fight over this? It's not. I don't think we need to fight over it, but is it too bad? Is it so awful to have a discussion about it? And it's not about hatred or fear. It's about not only preserving our culture, uniting our communities, and saving the tax dollars where they should be spent.
But there are some that what they're going to get out of this is this hyper nationalistic hatred of others. And that's my problem in this. And you know, my daughter, I had an opportunity this weekend to go to Liberty Island in New York with my 9-year-old daughter. And we got to see the Statue of Liberty, and we got to see exactly what we were just talking about, the three generations,
right,
standing side by side, from virtually every ethnicity we could imagine. And you could see it right in their faces. You knew the grandmother didn't speak any English. The father was the interpreter, or the mother was the interpreter. And the child was as American as any child in this country. So when I look at this, I got to be honest, I just see this as a waste of productive time and of energy, because eventually people do assimilate, at least everyone that I've met.
But eventually, along the way, Rick, you and I and every other taxpayer whose budgets are strained as well are paying more and more for it. And you know what? I think it's somewhat irresponsible, too, that no government, whether the federal or the state, tracks the expense. We have no idea, really, how much we're spending.
And
is that responsible?
That's something you should be looking at. And before you go passing something like this, maybe you should know what the numbers are. You know, because I'm sorry, the English is a second language thing. I don't think that applies to this, because as you said, that's going to continue on. My other problem with this is there's already Supreme Court case law on this. Back in the 1920s, there was Meyer versus Nebraska. It was ruled unconstitutional back then because it violated due process.
Well, there might be Supreme Court action, but there's also 31 states that have made this the law of their state.
So my question then becomes is how much of my tax dollars is going to go into fighting this, going to the Supreme Court to try and do this?
Because why is it your question how much your tax dollars are going to go to fight discrimination claims by those who say you provide services in this language but not in the next language?
Is it that hard to provide in someone's home language?
It's not hard. It's expensive. It's not hard. Let me ask you this. Why isn't it incumbent upon those who don't speak English to look at their computer, get a program that interprets and interpret for themselves? Why is Rick Smith and Scott Perry and everybody else paying for it?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's a good question. But here's the thing. You're citizens here.
Yeah.
You have rights. And
yeah.
That right is that your government has to communicate with you at some level. And there should be reasonable accommodation to make sure that you have that ability.
So I guess the question is reasonable then.
Well, I mean, if you have a document that is something you need to communicate with people, you should be able to at least communicate with them, no? I mean, haven't we been having this discussion since, well, the beginning of immigration, I guess.
The beginning of immigration. Rick, you must understand that our diversity is what makes us strong, but only in the fact that we're all seeking the same, generally speaking, seeking the same goal. If we all have our own interest in our diversity, then that makes us a fractionalized society. And I see this as a way to segregate us and people to find ways to divide and have their own little community among our community. How does that unite us?
Let me ask you a last question on this before, because I do have a couple of things I want to ask you. How's this going to play if we pass this with federal mandates, like voting rights?
The federal mandates will still be required. It doesn't have any effect to them whatsoever.
All right. So we're still going to print ballots for people to vote, but we're not going to tell them how to get to the voting poll, is what,
right.
what you're telling me. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that that's.
Well, we'll tell them, but we'll tell them in English.
Okay. Well, there you go. A couple other questions that I wanted to get to since I've got you. I look at this the scheme that Senator Pileggi has put forth.
Yeah.
I wanted to get your take on it.
Well, I am guarded about the thing. I don't like tampering with anything structural for the most part. And so, I still think just like the current system is a double-edged sword where some folks might not be happy this year and happy the next, this is the same thing. So, I, like I said, I'm guarded about the thing. I want to really proceed with caution. It concerns me, of course, that the governor and he are for it very quickly out of the gate, but I'm not saying I'm against it yet. I just need to sit there and say to myself, what's this really going to affect and why are we doing this? If it increases voter, participation without fundamentally putting our system out of whack, because I'm a guy that believes in the Electoral College, believe it or not. I think it can be a good thing because I'd like to see more people participate. But if we're just trying to do it so that one side has the upper hand over the other, I don't really think that any citizens really stand for that. They'd like to see, the adversarial relationship that we have so that public policy doesn't go too fast or too one-sided.
I personally think it's a power grab. And that's my partisan view. The other part of me says that what this will do if we do go down this path, it'll make Pennsylvania irrelevant.
Well, there's a lot of people that makes Pennsylvania relevant. Right now they say we're irrelevant, and that irritates a lot of people, which is why they don't go vote, especially during presidential elections, saying that the contest is already decided by the time we get there because, half the primary candidates have dropped out, regardless of which side of the aisle you're on.
I still view Pennsylvania as a swing state and one that could go either way for at any time.
Well, we always say that, but what's it really? How has it swung in the last two or three presidential elections? I mean, it hasn't been swinging much.
Yeah, but it's also been competitive, and there's been an awful lot of time, energy, and resource spent.
Also true.
You brought up the fact that you like to see people participate in the election, which kind of struck me on an interesting chord with all this voter ID stuff, this suppression that's going on. I've got a grandmother, 84 years old, hasn't had a driver's license in probably 10 years.
Right.
She doesn't have an ID. I know people who, don't have automobiles, don't have IDs.
Right.
They've been voting in the same polls for years. But now, here in Pennsylvania, we're talking about pushing through this another scheme to solve a problem that I don't think exists.
Well, you don't think it exists, Rick, because you don't see Philadelphia precincts that vote 100% even before the polls open. Listen, this fraud is out there, and it's fomented and conducted by both parties, okay? So let's not mince any words here. Is it really so bad to produce an identification when I have to produce one to buy liquor at the state store, when I have to produce one to get on an airplane, when I have to produce one for a myriad of different reasons, to buy cigarettes? I don't smoke, but if I did, they're supposed to card me. Really? You can't produce an ID to engage in the most precious right that Americans have. I don't think it's too much. I have to produce identification to avail myself to my Second Amendment rights.
Scott, at this moment in my life, I'll agree with you. Absolutely. Yeah. At this moment in my life, because I have the ability to go and get a license. I have the ability to do. I have the resources. If I need to pay for it, I can do that. My grandmother doesn't have the luxury of going downtown or getting out to the voting registration office during the times prescribed. There are poor people in this country who don't have the ability to take a day off work and to go do these things. So to me, it's one of those things that it looks like we're trying to hold that number of people going to the polls down. And that's what it looks like on an outward level.
I certainly can understand your perspective, but I just see it a different way. I see it as, yeah, absolutely, it is a burden to your freedom, and I'm a freedom guy. We have a lot of burdens on our freedom, but we're saying that it's more important that we have the integrity of the voting system in America preserved than have questions for the sake of a few folks that either refuse to, can't be bothered to, or really have a difficult time getting identification. And I would suspect, Rick, I certainly will tell you this straight up. If somebody calls my office and says, hey, look, I don't have a car, I don't have a whatever, I'm 80 years old, I got to get this identification from PennDOT and I can't get there. Give me your address, I'll be right over.
Okay, we're going to hold you. When you guys push this through, I will make sure we hold you to that.
Yeah, please do.
We will absolutely, because Nikki Haley down in South Carolina said the same thing, but when asked, kind of changed her mind. But we're going to hold you to your word there.
Okay, buddy.
Last question I've got for you, Rick. You know, looking at the wine and spirit shops.
Yeah.
I understand that House Bill 11 is going to be one of the first to run. What's the point of this? I mean, it's another privatization scheme, in my opinion, that we, the taxpayers, are not going to benefit from as we have from the sale and the holding of these stores as a public asset.
Well, listen, I mean, there's plenty of empirical data to say whichever side of the argument on that you're right. So, you know, figures lie and liars figure. But in a fundamental sense, I don't think of it as a scheme. I think what we have right now is a scheme. I don't understand why the state government is in the business of purveying what's a questionable substance to a lot of people at the same. So we're marketing that. We're using state dollars to market it. And then we tell you, oh, we really don't use it. And then we're going to set up a roadside checkpoint to you know, check everybody's breath, including mine, and I don't drink when I go through it, and hold me up from getting home to see my wife and kids. We're on the wrong side of the issue, and I think that the finances will bear it out. Might it be perfect as soon as we get out of the gate? It probably won't. But the plan now isn't perfect, and the liquor system contributes to the state fund. It's at its own peril. Governor Rendell raided it on several occasions and put them in arrears. I mean, that's number one. I mean, for me, it's just a fundamental, what is government, what should government be doing, what business should we be in, and we shouldn't be in the business of private business. We're one of two states that do this.
Right, and I would say we're in the business of protecting our citizens, because as it stands now...
But we're not getting rid of the LCB. The protection is still there.
But we're increasing the number of stores that are going to be carrying liquor. We're going to be increasing the opportunity, because I got to be honest, I grew up in Cleveland.
Yeah.
A place where I could walk into any 7-Eleven gas station, I can buy beer, I could buy wine, and I could buy anything under 42 proof.
Right.
And as a 15-year-old kid, I was able to do that quite often. As a parent who is now a hypocrite, I don't want my 15-year-old children to be able to do that. It's one thing when I was doing it.
Anybody below the age of majority and the age of the law to do so, to be able to avail themselves to it, and that's where strict and very heavy-handed enforcement has to come in. But we don't punish the law-abiding citizens in the district I represent and so many others that say, for the love of God, why must I travel 15, 20 miles to go to a state store with these arcane hours and I buy liquor here, and then I go buy a case of beer here and a six-pack there. Pennsylvania is in the 19th century on this thing, and that's number two. It's the right thing to do because we shouldn't be in the business, and number two, we better get in the 21st century and give the people, the voters, what they want. This is legislation's running because the voters want this.
Really? To be honest, most of the people that I talk to, they're like me. They're adults about their drinking habits. They know where alcohol is. When they need a bottle of something, they plan ahead. They know how to get it. To me, the system works just fine. It just seems to be a matter of, planning. I don't want alcohol, as I was, in Cleveland. I don't want it to be the impulse item next to the Tic Tacs on the checkout aisle.
Hey, listen, some people don't want it at all. Should we just get rid of it altogether? I mean, it creates all kinds of havoc and drunk driving, et cetera.
I'm not saying that.
I'm just saying
that it's an adult substance, and that adults should be adult about it, know where they get it, know how to consume it.
But I agree with you, Rick, but this is a free country, and if we're saying adults should be adult about it, why can't they exercise their freedom and be adults and act lawfully? And if they can't, then they need to be penalized, but we're punishing those who would act lawfully for the sake of the few that don't. That's not fair either.
No, on a slight level, you're right. But again, I've been in an environment where we have mass competition with liquor, and I see what happens.
Listen, I was in the environment too when I was growing up. Everybody drove south of to the border of Maryland, right across the line, to drink because their drinking age was still 18. Did that make it right? Absolutely not. And then the highway was littered with the bodies of teenagers that did that. But here again, is that the person that drinks responsibly and abides by the law's fault? And should we punish them?
I don't see that I'm being punished by having a store where I go to pick that up. That's just my
sure,
sentiment on
sure.
it. And that's something we'll probably disagree on, and we'll see where this whole thing takes us. Scott Perry, always great talking to you. Would love
to
have you back again real soon.
Yep, absolutely. Have a great evening.
Thank you. You too. Interesting. We're going to take a quick break. That was Representative Scott Perry. His website, repperry.com. We'll put a link at therickSmithShow.com if you're interested. We're going to take a break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show.
President Obama has joined the perky posse of national leaders who are urging Americans to be more upbeat about the economic doldrums we're in. Shake off all the naysaying and the anxiety and the hand-wringing, he recently told us, sounding a lot like a football coach telling a player to shake off a concussion and get back in the game. The president's pep talk came the day after he made his bold jobs proposal to Congress. But Obama's plan is more Walter Mitty-ish than Rooseveltian. While it does have some useful provisions to keep from losing still more jobs, the core of Obama's plan consists of two more corporate tax breaks, a form of bribery to induce enormously rich corporations to hire American workers. This is the same old that Washington keeps throwing at the problem, and hello, Washington, it's not working. Sure enough, corporate chieftains say they'll gladly take the latest handout, but we should not expect them to go on a big hiring spree. Mostly, they'll use the money to cover the few people they were going to hire anyway, and pocket the rest. Nonetheless, Obama is now barnstorming the country, rallying crowds to demand that Congress, quote, stop the political circus and actually do something to help the economy by passing his plan. Fine, but what about the corporate circus and the Wall Street circus? It's time to stop coddling these gluttonous narcissists. America is in crisis, sinking toward depression. The president should really get bold by calling out and shaming corporate executives who suck up America's wealth, then turn their backs on us, as though the only loyalty they owe is to their own avarice, none to their country. Likewise, he should kick the bailed-out bankers right in their ample butts and insist publicly that they start making loans to America's smaller businesses that do want to create good jobs in our country. This is Jim Hightower saying, let's stop begging and start demanding.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. English only, yes, no? Which way do we go with this? You know, this weekend for me was an interesting weekend. I had some business in New York City, and I had the opportunity to take my nine-year-old daughter to New York for her very first time. So I got to mix a little business, a little pleasure. I got to go to a friend's birthday party who, just is a wonderful salt of the earth, person. But it was one of those weekends where you come back from it and you go, there's a lesson in here. There's absolutely a lesson. And Saturday night, I'll just run through it, and maybe you'll see it too. Saturday night, we ended up at a friend's, her birthday party. It wasn't so much of a birthday party as it was a fundraiser, because she does an awful lot of philanthropic work. If it's not in Mississippi, it's in the Sudan. If it's not there, it's somewhere else. She's into everything. And one of the things she's done is she's been going to the Sudan for several years, taking them, you know, food and goats and you know, helping them sell, make jewelry and sell it back here and all kinds of stuff. And she met this one kid, his name was Kerr. And Kerr was a slave until his slave master, angry that he had allowed a goat to get out of his care, hung Kerr upside down, put chilies in his eyes, and lit a fire under him so that the smoke would burn his eyes. And this left Kerr blind. So Ellen saw this kid, found this kid, brought him back to the U.S., got him surgery so that this kid can see shapes, and he's not seeing too many colors, but he can see shapes and stuff out of one eye. So he's got some vision back. And my daughter was struck by this. I mean, you hear tales about people, about slavery being years and years ago, but to actually stand next to somebody who at one point in their life was a slave, and that they were beaten and tortured and blinded, is something very powerful. And we bought one of the necklaces that the folks back in the Sudan had made so that she would remember it, and that she would at some point down the line remember what a great country this is. And the next day we went to Liberty Island. Went to see the Statue of Liberty. And I got to be honest with you, I have never felt so proud, so patriotic, so in love with my country. That this beacon of freedom, this symbol to the world, where all the people around us, the mass of humanity, the thousands of people who are on Liberty Island with us, speaking every language that I couldn't even tell you. In generational form, grandma was there, grandpa was there, mom and dad, the kids, right down. And to have this unity in our country, to me, spoke something. It gave the message that, you know what, this is the melting pot. And it does work the way we had talked about earlier. The first generation comes, they struggle with the language. It's a difficult language. The kids, the second generation, they learn the language and they know both because they're the interpreter. And the third generation, they basically forget all of the first language. They're now solidly Americans. And you saw it played out. Indians, French, Russians, you know, all across the ethnicities, they were all there in one place admiring this beacon of freedom, this beacon of liberty. And I look at this and I think about how divisive and how this English-only thing can only divide us. And I understand the argument that our language unites us. No. Our love of freedom, our love of this country, our love of what this nation stands for unites us. That's what unites us. So I'm comparing these two things, the fact that all of these people are on this island adoring this statue, adoring this vision of this country. And the night before her having taken a photograph with a slave who had his vision stolen from him by an evil master. How do you explain that? And as we were coming back home, my daughter hadn't finished her homework. And it's one of those moments where you go, something cosmic is happening, something out of my control, something preordained, if you will. Her homework assignment was to research who Clara Barton was. And for anybody who knows, Clara Barton was a teacher. She was a nurse during the Civil War who gave aid and comfort to the soldiers. But she was also the founder of the American Red Cross. And I stopped and I thought about, you know, my friend Ellen, who does all of this philanthropic work around the world, and the aid and the comfort that she's given to people over the years, and how all of this just kind of comes together. And the final piece of it was she had to define, in her opinion, what a, quote, birds of a feather flock together mean. And I just, you know, my mind was working all around this, and I'm looking at this, and I'm going, you know, there's something here. This tribal mentality of that quote, this, you know, we're white people here, we speak this language here. That isn't what this country is about. You know, I remember as a kid, it was about the great melting pot. I remember the Schoolhouse Rock videos as of yesterday. We're the great melting pot, where we throw in a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and you're an American. I mean, this language thing, to me, is divisive on that front. Now, part of me cares less if we print everything in English, because it doesn't affect me. And it doesn't affect the vast majority of us. And with today's technology, I don't think it's all that hard to have things translated into just about any language with a computer program. So to be able to zip that off, I don't think is all that expensive. And what's, I guess, and this is where, you know, Representative Perry and I will agree, it's a travesty that we don't have a number. And I would suggest before they go ahead with this, before they ram this through and add us to a lot of xenophobic states like Alabama and Arizona, maybe, we got to find out what it costs. Just a thought. But I look at this, and I go back to my weekend. And I stood on that island. I looked at Lady Liberty, and I couldn't help but imagine people coming here for the first time and seeing that beacon of freedom, that shining torch in the distance, going, that is the free world. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And inside the statue, in the pedestal, you get to read the quotes of people who talked about just that. While we were sitting, we met an elderly gentleman who had tears streaming down his face. He was with his son, who, probably my age, maybe a little older, was talking about his father having come to this country and had actually come through, I'm guessing, one of the last people to go through Ellis Island. I'm trying to figure out how that happens. But, you know, this guy was considerably older. His father had told him the story of coming to this country and what that beacon of freedom meant. And I asked about the work that they had done, and it was hard manual labor. But they had that dream. And I look at this English-only stuff as a diversion away from building that opportunity, that dream, that American dream that if I work hard and I play by the rules, that I'm going to be able to support my family, that I'm going to be able to help my children, and that they're going to have a better life than I'm going to have. And they're going to be able to work hard. And they're going to be able to support their children. And their children will have a better opportunity. That is what we should be talking about. And I look at this, Jake, and to me, this whole thing is very simple. Very simple. It's a diversion. But it's something that has to be done at some point, because we have got people among us who want us divided.
I heard just recently, just in the last week or two, on talk shows, and I like to, you don't, but I do, I like to stay on top of what's happening locally. Oftentimes they're conservative, and they brought up this issue. And the reaction of the public oftentimes is exactly what you said it is. It's divisive. You can tell the comments towards this issue. There's resentment there towards people who maybe don't speak fluent English. There's almost some hatred there. And I think all that does is point out the differences, and it's divisive. And it just accentuates some feelings that some people have that these people are coming and taking our jobs. These people are a threat to us when, in fact, they're part of the American melting pot, and that's a very positive thing. And when you lose sight of that, when you have laws like this and attempts to divide us.
It is that simple. But, you know, at the end of the day, I have hope. I have the greatest hope. Because my daughter, on the way home, and we were talking about this, she saw it for what it was. And she saw the people there as just like us. And I'm hoping her generation is able to get past the things that have hung, not just our generation, but generations long past. And the reason I brought up the Know-Nothing Party of the 1840s and 1850s is because, you know, that was today's Tea Party. That was the xenophobic rage against the immigrants taking our jobs. That was the rage against these people coming in and wanting their government to represent them. That's what that was. It's, you know, when Representative Perry said, you know, this is nothing new, he was right. This is nothing new. This is, 180 years old. This is 200 years old. This is what we've been battling from the foundation of this country, because we have said, come here. This is the land of opportunity. This is the land of freedom. This is the land of liberty. But now we're saying, but when you come here, oh, got to be like us. And eventually they do become like us. Because if you saw those people on that island, you know, my daughter played with a couple of the kids that were there. And I have no idea where their parents were from or their grandparents. But they were American kids. They all knew the same stuff. They all did the same, played the same games. They were Americans. And that used to be, in my opinion, that used to be the call. That's what we needed. Got an email during the break. Andy writes, your state's in trouble with representatives like Scott Perry. Election fraud on both sides. Baloney. Effing baloney, he writes. This guy was awful. Just as awful. He buys into Republican BS. Andy, he is a Republican. He is a Republican representative from here in the area, and I got to give him credit. He's always nice enough to come on the program. We've asked him twice now, and it's been a cordial, you know, disagreement, if you will, but we have. Andy goes on to write on election IDs, electoral college reform, and privatization. This guy has got to be removed. I'm surprised you got this fascist on your show, and that's what he is, a complete fascist. It was hard to listen to him without losing my mind. Well, there you go. So, again, if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally. And very nice fascist. You know, a friend of mine just popped into my head. Went to high school with. His name was Jimmy Fong. His family was from China, I think. And they owned the local Chinese restaurant, of course. Which is kind of sounds almost racist, if you will,
or stereotypical.
But his family owned the restaurant. His parents spoke almost no English. He was bilingual. I wonder if his kids, and I should look this up, I wonder if his kids speak the old language or not. Because Jimmy was a good kid, and his parents were too. And I think of those things. And I think what the problem is we don't have that much experience globally. We've been kind of isolated. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the thing in New York, the Day of Rage, and they're not leaving. They're staying on Wall Street. They're not leaving. When Dustin Slaughter comes back, he's an activist and filmmaker from Philadelphia. He's going to fill us in on what's going on because he's on the ground. So stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Our weapons of solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood. The list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
Shorty. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On Thursday, the House passed what's been called by opponents the Outsourcers' Bill of Rights. H.R. 2587 hobbles the power of not just the National Labor Relations Board, but also the courts when it comes to acting punitively against companies that perform illegally. According to a statement signed by more than 100 professors who analyzed the legislation, the bill eliminates any meaningful remedy for an employer's refusal to bargain with a union in circumstances where it's required to do so before transferring or contracting out work. California Representative George Miller spoke passionately from the floor against the legislation, which went on to pass with a vote of 238 to 186.
This bill is really about working Americans all across this country, and they should pay very careful attention to this bill and to this debate, because it affects their livelihood, their ability to support their families, the safety of their jobs at work, the conditions under which they work, and their ability to participate in their increased productivity in higher wages and better conditions. This bill takes the rights away from workers, from all workers, all across the country. This isn't just about whether you belong to a union or not. This is about whether or not your employer can retaliate against you by taking your work away, by sending your work down the road or out of the country.
What's the real monstrous lie about Social Security? Doug Cunningham explains.
Don't believe the big lie that Social Security is teetering on bankruptcy and won't be there for future generations. It's a monstrous lie about Social Security. A new Social Security issue brief from the Center on Economic and Policy Research says that even if no further changes are made to the program, Social Security remains fully solvent through 2038. Recognizing the fact that Social Security is in no danger of failing, President Obama is leaving it out of his new deficit reduction proposal. Social Security in no way contributes to the deficit. For 77 years, it's paid for itself and generated huge surpluses. All that needs to happen to make sure Social Security is there for our elderly for another 77 years after 2038 is to require that Social Security taxes be paid on incomes above the current limit of $106,800 a year. That's according to an actuarial projection at socialsecurity.gov based on the Social Security Trustees 2010 report. If high-income folks pay the same Social Security tax as the rest of us, the program remains fully funded with no cuts in benefits. The big truth is that Social Security is rock solid, with only minor changes needed to fully fund it at current benefit levels for another 75 years.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So it looks like Roseanne Barr was out at the Occupy Wall Street protest, adding to the number of voices out on the street. And, you know, you look at this, and at some point you've got to go, Wall Street, you gotta pay your share. You're going to have to stop crashing our economy. And, you know, maybe, good corporate citizens, I don't know, maybe good citizens, since you want to be people anyway. Saturday, there were thousands of people out there on Wall Street. Now there are, I'm guessing, you know, hundreds of people still occupying. That's why I've asked Dustin Slaughter. He's an activist filmmaker from the Philadelphia area. He's also on the ground, one of the quote-unquote occupiers. Dustin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, no problem, Rick. I'm a big fan of the show.
I appreciate it. Tell me, what's it like on the ground there right now?
Right now, the energy is remarkably high. Considering that, you know, we've been sleeping out literally on the plaza, a lot of us on pieces of cardboard, and we got a strong wind coming from the World Trade Center site. It's been kind of difficult, but spirits are running really high here, and everyone's doing really good.
And this started on Saturday with the Day of Rage?
That's correct. Started on Saturday.
So what kind of turnout did you get, and what kind of reaction?
Well, on Saturday, it was pretty remarkable. We had, I've heard estimates anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 people. maybe even more than that. And it was just a very, very strong, strong showing of people power, you know, finally kind of standing up to these very powerful moneyed interests that have been wreaking havoc on our economy.
What kind of reception are you receiving now?
Very positive, actually. Lots of curiosity, too. I think the public is kind of, you know, obviously getting to know what the protesters are doing here, who they are, you know, what kind of messages they have for the public. But they've been remarkably receptive to what the protesters have to say, and just very friendly, actually.
Well, let's talk about what the protesters, what the occupiers have to say. What are the demands at this point?
Well, right now they are still deliberating on narrowing down a message, and I have pretty strong confidence that they'll be able to narrow something down in the near future. But right now, they seem to be talking a lot about an extraction tax, you know, cleaning up special interest money in elections and government, which I think is a big one. Student loan debt forgiveness, ending the war, and of course, you know, universal health care.
Those all sound like great things. You know, how are they coming to the to what? You know, how's this structure working out? How are they coming to these demands?
Well. You mean how are they deciding on what to
Yeah, how is this decision-making process going? Because, you know, in some of the conversations I've had, this is almost like Athenian democracy, if you will, where all the, you know, you're having meetings and all of the people are having some input. I'm just curious how that's working out.
It's a very, very slow process at times. It's a little frustrating. I've never quite seen anything like this, and it's taken a bit of getting used to. In the beginning, it was a little bumpy, you know, trying to get things rolling. But, you know, I just noticed it within even the past 24 hours that things have really kind of started to move forward. Where, you know, they're organizing regular protests to Wall Street twice a day. We have one planned for, you know, tomorrow morning for the opening bell as well as for the closing bell. And that's going to be a regular occurrence every day now. So the deliberation process is long, but they will be honing down on honing in on things in the near future.
No, I'm anxious to see what this comes out to. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Dustin Slaughter, activist, filmmaker from the Philly area. He's in New York City on Wall Street there with the Occupy Wall Street folks. You know, are you able to get onto Wall Street? Because when I was by there on Sunday, it looked like they had pretty much everything blocked off. It actually looked like there were more policemen there than anybody else. Can you tell me if you have that ability to get onto Wall Street?
Yes, on Sunday they did have it completely blocked off. There was like a, I guess a one or two block radius in which you can't even go near it. Today, however, was a completely different story. I don't quite know why they had it open today. I mean, obviously today was a work day,
right?
But I wasn't sure why they weren't screening people. But yeah, we were able to literally walk right in. I was filming the initial protest going into, down to the exchange and whatnot. But yeah, we got in and, it was interesting how the police had the barricade, set up. I guess you call them French barricades or something, but basically they cut the sidewalk in half with the barricades, so we were basically, what's the word I'm looking for?
You were segregated from everybody else.
A cattle chute.
Right.
And we were, you know, it was a very, very tight space. You know, we were very, very close to the people going to work and everything, and it got very tense at times, but the protest went off very well, so.
That's got to be an interesting scenario. You're heading off to work, and there's a line of protesters protesting you going on to Wall Street.
It was kind of funny.
That sounds like fun.
Some people had a look of complete awe and shock on their faces. They couldn't believe what they were seeing. People dancing in the streets, and you know, it was it was interesting to watch.
Yeah, I have all these wealthy people going, what do these kids want? And speaking of what they want, again, I want to go back through these again. I know you rattled them off, but I think they're important to go through a little bit at a time. This election reform, to me, is huge. Undoing Citizens United, telling corporate America, sorry, you don't have any blood or bones, you can't be a person. And I think that's the place to start. I think that is an excellent goal out of this.
Speaking purely as a commentator on this, I completely agree with you. I honestly feel that issue will be the one that will open up solutions to pretty much every other issue on that list. And I would also like to make a quick plug for U.S. Day of Rage, their one message, their focus is one citizen, $1, one vote. And there are national chapters springing up across the country, as you probably know. And their goal in the coming future is going to be creating trying to get the states to ratify a new constitutional convention in order to get just that demand onto the Constitution. So it's going to be very interesting to see where that group goes in the future as well.
Yeah, I agree, because at the end of the day, you can't have corporate people. Mr. Exxon and Mr. Halliburton, they have a lot more money to hold their rights up than Mr. Slaughter and Mr. Smith do.
Exactly.
The other ones on this I see as a little bit more divisive. The student loan debt forgiveness, while I agree there needs to be some action on this, this could be one of those messaging nightmares, along with the war, another one of those messaging nightmares that I think could detract about what they're trying to gain on Wall Street. Your thoughts?
Exactly. No, I completely agree with you. And, you know, just going back very, very quickly to the cleaning up of special interest money in elections and whatnot, that's something that, I mean, my father, for instance, is a libertarian, and he completely agrees with me on that, you know, and we're as far different ideologically as you can get. And that's an example of an issue that can really bring every American together, because it goes to the very, you know, the very bones of what, a democracy is supposed to be.
It's a fairness issue. I mean, it's an absolute fairness issue. And you can't possibly compete with the Halliburtons and the Exxons and the GEs, especially when these big multinational corporations are not even American companies anymore.
Precisely.
That's my problem. How long you plan on staying?
Well, I was planning on leaving tomorrow, but, I'm just really enjoying this. besides sleeping on the cold stone here.
Yeah,
I just really kind of enjoy this experience. I've never done anything like this before, and I think I'm going to stay another day.
Good for you. Because when we were in Wisconsin sleeping on the hard marble floor there in the Capitol, same kind of thing. You know, it's an exhilarating experience. The people you talk to who are there with you, how long, you know, what's the feeling? How long is this going to go on?
Well, I think people are somewhat surprised that they've been able to stay here as long as they have.
I am.
You know, if this lasts a week or two, if they are able to hold this plaza, I really do think that's going to be the start of something. Because, again, like I said, the public reaction to this has been amazing. I mean, like, you know, the occupiers, the protesters have been engaging the public on a daily basis, talking to them. And it's this massive public forum where people can just, it's a free exchange of ideas. And, you know, I think that this, it has momentum right now. And if they can keep it going for a week or two, I think that this is the beginning of something really interesting.
No, good. We'll see what happens. Last question, as a filmmaker, what are you planning on this? Are you filming? What are you doing?
Yeah, I'm actually making a short film for the web, actually, of the weekend of my duration of staying here, and I hope to put it up on the internet soon. So.
Well, when you get that done, let us know, and we will make sure that we get it out as well.
I will certainly do that. Thank you, Rick.
Dustin Slaughter, appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Activist filmmaker, as you heard, he's gonna do a little film, and we will make sure that we get that out. We're gonna take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
3,000 people screaming out. Where's our government?
Lawsuits and arraignments. Members under company surveillance. Public divided into their lovers, all they hate. Brought billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have broken through a gap.
That we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer.
One day longer.
The people's voice is stronger.
The people's voice is stronger.
We got a hard form on the people talk with respect. Keep fighting for these rights to generations that's next. One day longer.
Radio experience where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
President Obama has joined the perky posse of national leaders who are urging Americans to be more upbeat about the economic doldrums we're in. Shake off all the naysaying and the anxiety and the hand-wringing, he recently told us, sounding a lot like a football coach telling a player to shake off a concussion and get back in the game. The president's pep talk came the day after he made his bold jobs proposal to Congress. But Obama's plan is more Walter Mitty-ish than Rooseveltian. While it does have some useful provisions to keep from losing still more jobs, the core of Obama's plan consists of two more corporate tax breaks, a form of bribery to induce enormously rich corporations to hire American workers. This is the same old that Washington keeps throwing at the problem, and hello, Washington, it's not working. Sure enough, corporate chieftains say they'll gladly take the latest handout, but we should not expect them to go on a big hiring spree. Mostly, they'll use the money to cover the few people they were going to hire anyway, and pocket the rest. Nonetheless, Obama is now barnstorming the country, rallying crowds to demand that Congress, quote, stop the political circus and actually do something to help the economy by passing his plan. Fine, but what about the corporate circus and the Wall Street circus? It's time to stop coddling these gluttonous narcissists. America is in crisis, sinking toward depression. The president should really get bold by calling out and shaming corporate executives who suck up America's wealth, then turn their backs on us, as though the only loyalty they owe is to their own avarice, none to their country. Likewise, he should kick the bailed-out bankers right in their ample butts and insist publicly that they start making loans to America's smaller businesses that do want to create good jobs in our country. This is Jim Hightower saying, let's stop begging and start demanding.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
This is the most unfortunate situation that I have seen in a long time in Washington as a result of one or two people who just really were not willing to compromise. They wanted their way. And as a result of them wanting their way, 70,000 construction workers are idle in construction projects around America at airports, and 4,000 FAA employees are not receiving paychecks and haven't received paychecks for more than 10 days.
You know, that was back during the shutdown of the FAA. Fortunately, they've got a short-term deal, but again, another short-term deal where we could be right back in that position again in a mere 6 months. So again, you know, you look at this and you go, governing poorly. This is what has been brought to us by the GOP. There you go. Our quote of the day comes from Sally Khan in her piece over at CNN called Time to Raise Taxes on the Rich. She says, at what point do we realize enough is enough? That giving more and more money and power to big business and the super rich will never translate into more jobs, better wages, and a better economy, but simply more yachts and more luxury villas. And I would argue an entire separate transportation system. They've got their private jets. They've got their private airports. A whole, you know, when the, I loved when the auto people came into town, when the auto CEOs came into town, they all came in on their jets, landed in their private airports, shuttled in on their chauffeur-driven limousines. Not our world, man. It's just not where we live. And you look at the fact that in the state of Pennsylvania, we've got about a $3.5 billion shortfall in our transportation. And there's no way of filling that right now because everybody's talking about slash and burn, cut, and punish. Everyone's talking about, oh, let's push it back onto the states, like Grover Norquist. Oh, let's let the states do it. No federal funding, and they're going to fight the highway bill. You watch. They're going to fight federal dollars for building projects, and you know why? Those greedy workers. Those construction workers who, you know, because federal projects, Davis-Bacon applies, prevailing wage. Oh, we can't pay those people decent wages. No, we want to boat them in from other countries like we used to so we can exploit them. Sounds like that. I guess it is the American way, but that's part of it. And the other part is the privatization. They really want to privatize what is ours. And I came back from New York, and I got to tell you, Jake, New York is in serious trouble. I spent an extra $18 just to get back from the Statue of Liberty back to Brooklyn because they just decided arbitrarily to close the ramps to the Brooklyn Bridge. So you couldn't get up on it. I had to go all, what a nightmare. But again, you know, an infrastructure in decline and dying.
And New York was never easy to get around. I mean, you should know this as a truck driver, but I've been up there to some sports events. New York has never been easy, and apparently it's even worse.
Yeah, I listen to people talk about our turnpike here. And the turnpike is a very nice road. Why? Because we put money into it to keep it up. And I love when people say, well, you know, we shouldn't have tolls on the road because we already paid for it. Yeah, we already paid for it. I bought that car, so I shouldn't have to put tires on it or oil in it, or I shouldn't have to fix it, but I paid for it. That's the mentality. Very, very closed-minded. I was watching C-SPAN the other night, and Ed Rendell was on a panel with Grover Norquist, and it was, you know, it was hysterical to look at this panel and go, Ed is a serious lefty on that panel. And when you talk about infrastructure, he said, look, if you're not investing, if we're not investing in our infrastructure, in our airports, in our ports, in all of these things, we're going to become a second-rate power. And he said, you know, the World Economic Forum, they're the people who rated our infrastructure best in the world, number one, as late as 2005. So now you go 6 years of no investment. Now we're 15th in the world. Went from first to 15th in 6 years. In air transportation, Ed said, 32nd, behind countries like Panama and Malaysia. In the port infrastructure, you know, we're behind, we're trailing, we're about 22nd, I think he said. Rails, we're 22nd. I mean, this used to be the envy of the world. And it used to be the place where business was able to get their products to and from. I went into New York, and I got to be honest, I don't know how they get the things they need into that city. I have no idea. It is an absolute nightmare. And I've talked about it before. We've seen airports, Logan and LaGuardia, each within the last several months have had accidents where planes just run into each other. They're driving on the runway, and boom, somebody was in the way. And I look at this story from China. Beijing they're in the process of building an airport three times the size of Heathrow. Something that's going to be able to handle up to 200 million passengers a year. They are investing heavily, heavily. And look, the people there, they want air travel. But what gets me, you look at what's going on in China. They are spending, building infrastructure, building roads, building bridges, solar, alternative energy, you name it. They are investing heavily. It's us. It's we, you, me, who are going, oh, let's talk about English only. Let's talk about voter ID. Let's talk about selling off the state assets. Oh, let's talk about how we can cut education. And I go, you know what? You look at the Chinese, you look at other countries investing, investing. They're building. They're educating their children. We're the dumb ones here. We're the ones who are saying, no, got to have a billionaire class. You know, we don't want to be divided. We don't want to divide each other. You know, we need that, those, what, 1,400, 1,500 billionaires? Got to have them. That's our national pride now? That we've got 1,500 billionaires, but we got more poverty than we've had? That's our national treasure? That we don't educate our kids worth a damn anymore? Is that our national treasure? No, we've got billionaires.
By the way, did you catch the governor over the weekend, Rick? He's trying to make excuses. He's saying, you know, that rainy day fund that the Democrats wanted me to use for education, well, you know, we might have to use it because of what happened with the latest tropical storm. I mean, I think that's a bit disingenuous. I think he's trying to make excuses and deflect some blame. I mean, this administration obviously is very anti-education.
Oh, gee, aren't you glad we cheated those kids out of education so we could pay for your big screen TV?
You know, he's acting like, well, you know, he has the wisdom of Solomon and he foresaw all these emergencies that were going to happen. So therefore, by being $1 billion short in, funding education, he did the right thing. Well, that's just pooey. That's just, redesigning history.
You know, and I look at this and I go, this is not the country that I, just 10 years ago, thought we were. I thought we had vision. I thought we had foresight. I thought we were the creators. We were the entrepreneurs. We had the spirit of innovation. What it turns out to me looks like, all we are is just greedy, narcissistic, self-centered, me, me, me. I ask the question, what are we going to leave for my kids? What are we going to leave for their kids? My grandfather's generation, and for the last couple of weeks, since Labor Day, I've been talking a lot about it. Because their generation epitomized what it means to be selfless. They fought the wars. They fought the wars at work. And they invested heavily in this nation, making this a first-rate nation. There's part of me that I remember having conversations with my grandfather about the idea that they built this massive infrastructure of highway. And at the time, they wanted the treasure of the world. Everything was, and the mentality was, whatever we need to do to be number one. Whether it was in sports in the Olympics, whether it was putting someone on the moon, whether it was, building this highway system, whether it was fighting poverty. It was all, how can we be the best? How can we be number one? And, I go back to my trip to Lady Liberty. That beacon, that, to me, have you ever been there, Jake?
I haven't. I've seen it from a distance, traveling around New York, but I've never been there.
There's something much, and I have too. I've driven to New York, and you see it off in the distance, and there it is. And I've seen pictures, but it's wholly something different to stand there right under it and look up at it. There's something different about being inside of it and having that feeling that this is truly something remarkable, truly something purely, just something. The symbol of our country. I mean, you say the bald eagle. No, that is the symbol of our country. That is what people think of. That beacon of freedom and of liberty and prosperity and opportunity and all of that. That's what they think of. And to have that was just and to be around the mass of humanity that you knew was thinking the exact same thing. To me, was just one of those truly inspiring moments. And, one of those moments where you realize how much you love your country. And when, again, I go back to, this, all these privatization schemes, all of this stuff on how we're going to destroy the, it just angers me. All of this, we need to get billionaires more. All of this, we need to protect job creators. Yet all I see are people going, we need to cut more employees because, oh, gee, there's more stock for me.
You know, you talk about Ike Eisenhower, and he's kind of become our favorite president, and quite frankly, you've educated me a little bit. And when you talk to Republicans and you talk to conservatives and you talk about Ike Eisenhower, you talk about the top rate for the very wealthy, and you tell them that, you know, during Ike Eisenhower's administration, it was 92%, and you know what? We flourished. We flourished. We expanded as an accelerated rate. We were the greatest nation. We got even stronger economically and militarily. And you know what? Those 92%ers, they found out ways to exist. And through, because of that 92%, we funded a lot of colleges and a lot of universities and a lot of public buildings and a lot of libraries. I don't think we've actually gotten, the Democrats certainly haven't done a good job on it. And I'm not saying we should go back to 92%. First of all, it's not you'd never get it, and probably not practical. But the concept of the wealthy paying their fair share, I don't think the Democrats have done a good job really explaining where we came from as a nation.
And those are discussions that have to be had. I mean, what we're seeing now, well, you know, and I've heard this over and over again. Well, you know, the taxes don't create jobs. Yeah, well, tell that to all the people who built those roads. Tell that to all the people who, teach your children. Tell that to all the people who protect you abroad. Tell that to all the people who protect you on the streets. Tell that to the people who put the fire out. Tell that to the people who are doing all of the things that government does. Now, look, you know, I'm like anybody. I fear my government as much as anybody. But I'll be honest with you right up front. There are some tasks that I believe my government, of for and by, we the people, should do over a corporation. At the end of the day, I still have the opportunity, as much as I may not like the policies that Representative Scott Perry pursues, I have the opportunity, and his constituents have the opportunity, to show him the door and elect somebody else. And he will be judged on this English-only bill and a lot of the other ones that he's put forth. And people have the opportunity to say, you know what, didn't like it, you got to go. But a private for-profit corporation, with the radical self-interest of themselves, you have no say. They will have you sent away or locked away. So there's a lot to think about there. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Let's talk about this privatization scheme that's coming up. HB 11, right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing Life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job. They're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse, because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can check out the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app and take your program on the go. Also, you can drop me an email, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So, the privatization schemes are fast, they're furious, and, of course, they're very profitable. And you look at the fact that numerous states across the country are struggling with budget deficits. They've got to figure out, how are we going to pay for police? How are we going to pay for fire? How are we going to pay for education? How are we going to do all these things? And you know what? There are those, the profiteers among us, who are saying, well, sell off those assets, and we'll give you a little money up front. We'll give you some pennies up front, help you close those short-term budget deficits so you can get reelected. Yeah, sell off your assets. And one of the latest schemes is in the prison industry, because, you know, the U.S. is one of the biggest holders of people in the world. The last numbers I saw, we have more people incarcerated by number, by per capita, and by percentage than any country on this planet. Which is really kind of saying something. When you stop, you think about countries like China, Iran, the Sudan. Pretty impressive category. I mean that's something, you know, worth pumping your chest and waving that finger. We're number one. But the privateers, you know, the profiteers are out there saying, oh yeah, sell us your stuff. And you look at Florida, who, you know, they're saying maybe leading the way. 29 prisons they want to privatize. 29 of their prisons. Arizona, they've got, they've just wrapped up a bunch of hearings. They want to privatize, a number of their prison operations. Ohio, we talked about last week, sold one of them for $73 million. Only going to take about two and a half years for those people to make their money back. What's really ironic, though, and it's one of those things that kind of frustrates me, is, you know, most of the time the people who buy the prisons or buy our state assets use our money to do it. And then they get to take not only the money and the asset, but we end up paying them in the long run for the thing back. So for them, it's a win-win. Us, well, lose-lose. But here again, you know, this is what they're telling us. This is what we need to do, is how we fill the budget gaps. Privatize. Outsource. And, you know, the question I always ask, and you look at Florida, Florida's going to go from about 5% up to about a third of their prisons being privatized. And the question I ask is, does it save us any money, or is it just shifting it around? And in this article in the Financial Times, it quoted John Rivera, president of the Police Benevolent Association, saying it simply doesn't save any money. He said they told legislators in the community that it would save millions per year, and now they're already $25 million over budget. Texas, they've got a huge number of privatized prisons. They're saying it's at a low cost because, you know, they're able to cheat their workers. And that's where all of this ends up. If they can privatize, they can cheat workers out of their pay, out of benefits, maybe even, you know, not pay workers' comp or not pay unemployment or any of the other things along with it. So it's on the backs of who? The workers, again. And now you've got only two companies. You've got a duopoly. This Corrections Corporation of America, which we've talked about, and this other one, Geo Group, who just bought off the third one, and I'm going, how'd that happen? Well, they let it happen. $730 million investment from Geo took over Cornell, and now you've got these two companies basically going to have prison wars. And now you stop and you think about, how did this happen? How did we get to this point? You know, the private prisons have pushed for all of these minimum sentencing. The war on drugs was, just a boon. Mandatory minimum sentencing, all this stuff. And at the end of it, it's not about making society safer. It's not about doing for us. It's about putting money in their pockets. It's about privatizing and profitizing. And I look at the scheme here in Pennsylvania. Another privatization scheme to steal an asset from you and me in way of the wine and spirits shops, the liquor stores. To me, just dumb. For a number of reasons. The first one being, I don't want my kids having access to this substance. I think the system's fine just the way it is. Secondly, I don't want more of them. They're already enough. I know where they are. They're talking about 1,250 licenses. They're talking about increasing the number of licenses. And what I love is how they break them up. 750 of these licenses are going to go to Walmart or to supermarkets. So now you're going to have a chain. You know, and I've asked this. Does a chain, is that one license? Does Walmart have one license? And then how much opportunity, how much is this is out there? And then they say they're going to have 500 set up for mom-and-pop operations. You know, mom-and-pops like, you know, 7-Eleven, Walmart, or Wawa, Sheetz, you know, mom-and-pop operations. So now you're talking about 1,250 stores. And I think there are only 800 now, right? 750? So now you're talking about an additional 500 of these licenses. And there's another scheme in there. It's called this per gallon tax. And what they're doing is they're setting up the future for failure. They're going to put a not a sales tax. You're not going to have, when you go into the store, you pay your 6 or 7% on the price of the item. No, you pay a gallon tax. So if you go in, you buy that bottle of Dom Perignon, you're going to pay a gallon tax. But if you go in there and you buy that box of wine, you're going to pay a much higher tax. So explain to me how it's smart to have that system. Oh, yeah, we need the rich people. We want to make sure the guy buying the $300 bottle of wine gets a tax break. And the poor wino who's going to get in there, go in there and get his box of Ripple, he's going to get screwed. That seems to be the thing. And here's the thing with this gallon tax. The years down the road, 10, 15 years down the road, as inflation eats away at this tax, because the price will go up. Understand the price always goes up. The tax will not. As we're with a sales tax, which is a percentage, it goes up with the price. So if a bottle of wine goes from 10 to 20 bucks, the tax goes up. 6% of 10 bucks, 6% of 20 bucks. There's your difference. This gallon tax, this gallonage tax, doesn't do that. You're taxed on the gallonage. I mean, it's amazing, amazing scheme. And I'm sure Grover Norquist gave it the thumbs up. Because, you know, all the Republicans took their little pledge, can't increase taxes. So what they've done, gallonage tax. Beautiful thing. But HB 11 is coming, Jake, and it'll be interesting to see where this goes, because a lot of the language people are talking about, oh, well, you know, it's been sold well. It's going to close the budget gap, all of this stuff. It ain't. You're not going to get the money per license to do any of that. What you're going to end up with is a system that's now uncontrolled. Because, you know, I worry about that. And call me a hypocrite. I'm okay with that. In this scenario, I am a hypocrite. I don't want my kids to have the same access that I had, period.
Well, we talked about the negatives, and one of the negatives was it happened in other states when it went from a controlled system to a privatized system. Alcohol consumption among underage drinkers went up. Alcohol consumption among those who break the law. Alcohol consumption with drunk drivers. There is a price to be paid. And unfortunately, this time, we didn't see those advocates, like the Mad Mothers. We didn't see them, who, by the way, were very powerful and very effective the last time they tried to privatize. We didn't see that. But then when you look at the numbers and you look how they're constructing it, you can only come to the conclusion that there is no way that you are not going to have an increase in crime involving alcohol. It's just a given. And that's something that apparently those who back privatization are willing to accept.
Got an email during the break. Says, William writes, Rick, private liquor stores are always a favorite of armed robbers. And, you know, there's some truth to that. I mean, how many of our state stores have been robbed? How many times you see somebody walk in and rob one of the state stores? It's not something you see often. But you go to some cities like, you know, like D.C. or you go to cities like Cleveland, that kind of stuff happens more often than it should. And I don't want to end up like D.C. where there's a liquor store on every corner. Would you like some chips? I got liquor over here. Would you like some T-shirts? We got some liquor. Would you like a hoagie? Yeah, we got some liquor. Where everything is, now it's right there. It's an impulse buy. Yeah, I'm feeling kind of down today. Let me drown my sorrows in a Jack of Fifth.
You know, another issue we have, hasn't really been vetted. When you have the private, when you have the control system, you have people whose one and only job is to monitor the amount of alcohol so that the state gets the proper amount of tax in return.
Yeah, that's too difficult.
Are we going to have that with a privatized system?
No, we're going to pay that extra 1% away.
I have serious doubts about that.
We're going to pay that extra 1% away for people paying their taxes on time.
Not to mention the, what is it, about 4,500 good-paying jobs you're gonna throw away?
This is robbery, plain and simple. This is a theft of a public asset, plain and simple. Nothing more than this. This is handing for-profit interests a diamond in the rough. And the thing is, we're benefiting from it. It's our diamond. But they're going to make it work. And to their benefit, not ours. Understand that. You and I, when this goes through, screwed again. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Don't know much biology. Don't know much about the science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
My name is Michelle Bachman. I stand here in the midst of many friends and many family members to announce formally my candidacy for President of the United States.
Well, you know, she stands there with a lot of her imaginary friends as well. You know, I got to tell you, I love Michelle Bachman. She has proven to me that crazy is... crazy's hot. I love crazy. But you know, the thing is, what bothers me is not only is she crazy, she's deluded. You know, she was on the stump recently, and again, you know, it's one of these things where you go, we can disagree, but this is a bit outrageous.
And not only repealing Obamacare, also repealing Dodd-Frank, which is killing the banking industry. I've got the bill to repeal both of them.
The banking industry is dying. We're killing it. We're killing it. We're regulating it. We're just killing it. The poor banking industry, we need to feel so sorry for them. J.P. Morgan's profits up 13%. Citigroup's profits only up 23%. Wells Fargo's profits only up 29%. Goldman Sachs, they were only able to double their profits. Morgan Stanley, their profits were only up 17%. I ask you, can we do away with these job-killing, banking-killing regulations, please? We need to make sure that the banking industry and the criminals on Wall Street can collapse our economy again. I will only feel better as an American. I will only feel positive self-esteem when we have 2,000 billionaires. I'm not happy with 1,500. I want 2,000 billionaires. And if that means all those kids have to go hungry, then so be it. And if it means they just don't get to learn to read this year, I'm okay with that. Just as long as we get to that magical number of 2,000 billionaires. That's real national pride. I don't care if bridges fall down and planes fall out of the sky. Just as long as we have more billionaires. That's what I want. Let's all take a moment. Silent prayer for billionaires. That's all I'm going to ask. Billionaires. I mean, isn't it nuts? I mean, really, you stop and think about it. It's just plain nuts. I mean, it's kooky on so many levels. The profits are through the roof. The CEOs are lying in their pockets. Investors are thrilled. But these job-killing regulations, oh, they're going to kill them. You know, we had some pretty good regulations. Glass-Steagall was a pretty good oversight mechanism. From the end of the Depression up until Clinton signed off about it in 99, did a pretty good job. Kept banks and gambling houses separate. Said if you want to be a bank, you can be a bank. Said if you want to be an investment corporation, you company, you do that. We're not going to let you do both. Seemed like a good idea to me. Seems like a good idea again. We should go back to it. But Dodd-Frank doesn't even do that. So to say that, that these regulations are so onerous, how did you operate before? Well, less profit for them, more service for us. Also, tomorrow is the big day when Don't Ask, Don't Tell goes away, which I'm sure, makes the Bachman clan very happy. She was on Jay Leno, and Leno had asked her about the gay therapy thing that her husband does. And,
Well, that whole pray the gay away thing, I don't get that.
Well, see, I think when I heard that, I really thought it was like a kind of a midlife crisis line. Mm-hmm. A pray away the gray. That's what I thought it was.
So,
yeah, that was funny, wasn't it? And that was kind of the response she got. Nothing but crickets. I thought it was a touch of gray. I thought it was pray away the gray. Oh, that's a knee slapper, honey. You should go on tour. And, in fact, quit your day job. Please. Nuts. Speaking of someone who should quit their day job, Nikki Haley, she's one of these, another one of these people I love, great porn name. Like Bachman, loves to throw things out there, even if they're not true. She had been using this frame that, she knew that half of the workers there in the state couldn't pass a drug test, and that she wanted everybody to be drug tested. And she was pointing to this Savannah River nuclear site. And she said, it was unbelievable. Everybody they interviewed, half of them failed the drug test. So all these people failed the drug test. So we need to make sure that everybody's drug tested. Well, now she's saying, I don't know what you're talking about. She was wrong. Her exact quote is, "I never felt like I had to back up what people tell me. You assume that you're given good information, and now I'm learning through you guys that I have to be careful before I say something." Yes, you do have to be careful. Because facts are what they are. You can't just make stuff up. Look, I know a lot of people like to reach behind and pop it out of the dark side of the moon. You can't. Stop it. Much like Michelle Bachmann. Well, a woman told me that her son got the shot and now she's retarded. And you thought that was a good story to then turn to go on? And now we're finding that, quite possibly, it was an imaginary friend who told her this. I'll tell you, scary, scary stuff. You want to talk about some scary stuff, too? Pat Robertson. You know who he is, Jake?
Absolutely.
The way out there. I think he's...
Former presidential candidate.
Unfortunately, I think he's slipping.
Yeah.
I think in his old age, he's now, you know, just blurting stuff out. He had said that it was okay for a spouse to divorce the other one if they had Alzheimer's. Because, you know, they're kind of dead anyway. You know, so you could just go on, move on with your life, you know, leave them alone. Now taking some shots for being irresponsible and callous. Because, you know, you kind of think about it. One person said that, you know, he's unchristian-like and unbiblical and dead wrong. You know, so taking some good shots there. And, you know, when I heard him say it, I go, wow, that had to be a mistake. And no, he meant it. And I'm going, you know, where in the scripture does that? Thou shalt not be divorced, and thou shalt not commit adultery unless your spouse is.
One thing just went through my mind. Was he perhaps? No, can't say it ain't so. Say it ain't so. He couldn't have slipped out of God's grace that far. Although, you never know.
Well, you know. Maybe he was taking a little bit of the wine.
Sacrificial wine.
Well, of course. We wouldn't suggest anything otherwise. Governor Rick Perry back on the stump. You know, and what I've been hearing come out of Perry, which is amazing, is, you know, this whole Texas is the economic machine. We're a job creator. We're job creators. We create, you know, all the jobs. You know, 40% of all jobs. We done it. We done it right here in Texas. Created. We're the creators. But, you know, the reality is one of five people in Texas are below the poverty line, well above the national average. You know, you have Texas being the sixth ranking state in the country with people living in poverty. You've got over 18% of the people in poverty there. The Census Bureau, you know, when they released their numbers last week, national average 15%. You also have the highest share of people who do not have health insurance. You have the lowest spending per capita on your citizens, so you're not providing the services that most states are providing. You have most of the minimum wage jobs. There's very little help for people who are struggling, and you very much have a two-class society. You have the people who are doing very, very well, and the people who are not, and everybody else. And, you know, the question then becomes, is this what we want the country to look like? Do we want the United States to look like Texas? And I would argue, no, we don't. We don't need more minimum wage jobs. What we need are good paying union jobs, good factory jobs, good manufacturing jobs. Maybe, just maybe, you know, some that pay, oh, I don't know, a living wage instead of the minimum wage. Because to me, the minimum wage should be the living wage. You should not work 40 hours in this country and be in poverty. Sorry, shouldn't happen. Never. And the way you do that is you have a fairer tax system. Get these companies wanting to pay their employees a little bit better. And I look at Schakowsky's Fairness and Taxation Act, and it's pretty simple to me. And you make between one and ten million dollars, you pay 45% tax. You make over $1 billion, you pay 49%, and it's graduated up to that. That seems rational to me. This way we have the ability to, help people get job training. I mean, look at these trade agreements. The Republicans are fighting vehemently about putting trade adjustment assistance in there. And you look at every one of these bills down the line. And I don't know how you can look at this and go, this is the direction we want the country to go. Everything, and maybe it's that optimism. Maybe it's that belief that I'm going to be a millionaire someday. I'm going to be one of those 1,500 billionaires someday. All I need to do is win the lottery or find some widget the Chinese want to make. Because we don't make things anymore. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Adam Weinstein. national security reporter with Mother Jones about this this GI Bill and these for-profit colleges. Back after this.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On Thursday, the House passed what's been called by opponents the Outsourcer's Bill of Rights. H.R. 2587 hobbles the power of not just the National Labor Relations Board, but also the courts, when it comes to acting punitively against companies that perform illegally. According to a statement signed by more than 100 professors who analyzed the legislation, the bill eliminates any meaningful remedy for an employer's refusal to bargain with a union in circumstances where it's required to do so before transferring or contracting out work. California Representative George Miller spoke passionately from the floor against the legislation, which went on to pass with a vote of 238 to 186.
This bill is really about working Americans all across this country, and they should pay very careful attention to this bill and to this debate, because it affects their livelihood, their ability to support their families, the safety of their jobs at work, the conditions under which they work, and their ability to participate in their increased productivity in higher wages and better conditions. This bill takes the rights away from workers, from all workers, all across the country. This isn't just about whether you belong to a union or not. This is about whether or not your employer can retaliate against you by taking your work away, by sending your work down the road or out of the country.
What's the real monstrous lie about Social Security? Doug Cunningham explains.
Don't believe the big lie that Social Security is teetering on bankruptcy and won't be there for future generations. It's a monstrous lie about Social Security. A new Social Security issue brief from the Center on Economic and Policy Research says that even if no further changes are made to the program, Social Security remains fully solvent through 2038. Recognizing the fact that Social Security is in no danger of failing, President Obama is leaving it out of his new deficit reduction proposal. Social Security in no way contributes to the deficit. For 77 years, it's paid for itself and generated huge surpluses. All that needs to happen to make sure Social Security is there for our elderly for another 77 years after 2038 is to require that Social Security taxes be paid on incomes above the current limit of $106,800 a year. That's according to an actuarial projection at socialsecurity.gov based on the Social Security Trustees 2010 report. If high-income folks pay the same Social Security tax as the rest of us, the program remains fully funded with no cuts in benefits. The big truth is that Social Security is rock solid, with only minor changes needed to fully fund it at current benefit levels for another 75 years.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the driving zone? And I always feel like somebody's watching me.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app. You know, since 9/11, we've been seeing a lot of schemes, a lot of scams, a lot of ways to bilk the public, a lot of ways to bilk the government. But this latest one that we've been talking about, these for-profit universities and colleges, who have, you know, they preach a good game, but they also, highest default rates, high tuition, and not much at the end of it. To me, seems like a scheme. That's why I've asked Adam Weinstein, national security reporter over at Mother Jones, to come talk to us about his piece, How Pricey For-Profit Colleges Target Vets GI Bill Money. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Adam's name. Adam, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this, and again, to me, it seems like another screw job of taxpayers' money and taking advantage of these soldiers returning.
Oh, there's no question. You know, this all started with the best of intentions. Since 9/11 and in the years, you know, since then when we've had sort of this up-tempo multiple wars overseas, Congress and the American public wanted to do something to sort of compensate the service members for it and you know, give them some tangible benefits when they returned and tried to integrate into society. And then the expanded VA bill, GI Bill was part of that, but the problem is that it's also turned out to be incredibly profitable for these for-profit universities.
And to layer that out, Education Management Corporation from Pittsburgh, evidently in 2009 went from $2 million worth of revenue to over $52 million just a year later, to amplify your point, and as did Kaplan University, which, as you point out in your piece, owned by the Washington Post, went from $2.6 million in 2006 to almost $50 million last year.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, spending on military education has probably gone up about, it's gone up to $10 billion. That's probably about double in the last couple of years. For-profit schools share of that money has gone up 600%. So, you know, there's sort of an outsized expansion here. It's just whether they're private schools or they're publicly held, investors are seeing that there's you know, government cash to be had. And there are a lot of other side benefits. It helps them bring in a lot of other DOE money, too, if they can get their hands on some veterans benefits.
That's just amazing to me. And you look at the numbers, you know, the people over at Think Progress have done some work on this, and the default numbers are through the roof. It's just amazing to me that we are allowing this to happen, to continue, actually.
Well, that's, you know, that's an interesting point. Is Senator Cantwell has been kind of spearheading another move, saying that one of the problems that we have with military members coming back from overseas is having trouble translating their job skills to, you know, civilian workforces. And one of the ways that they do that is by trying to, you know, bootstrap themselves up with education. But what they find when they use their GI Bill for for-profit schools is getting credits that are from a non-accredited university, at least not from anywhere that, you know, other employers recognize. And frankly, there are unemployed people out there going to good state universities and good Ivy Leagues, and when they have a choice between that and the University of Phoenix grad, nine times out of ten, the University of Phoenix grad is going to miss out.
Yeah, I mean, because it just has the reputation of, in my opinion, and I'm not sure how this is in the industry, but it's just kind of shady and kind of a ripoff.
A lot of vets have felt cheated that way. Senator Harkin is one of the folks up on the Hill that sort of spearheaded this issue, and I know that several Democratic senators are actually going to be making some public announcements and putting out some new data on for-profit schools and their kind of exploitation of veterans in the GI Bill this week. But, you know, they did hearings in the past, and we had veterans get up there and said they felt misled, deceived, outright lied to. They ended up with big bills so that these for-profits were not only taking, you know, their benefits but also adding some big private loans onto their names at the end. And a lot of people got some sticker shock.
You know, what amazes me, and I look to this for-profit college set up as what's going to happen to, you know, to elementary school and high schools down the road as we begin to privatize and profitize K-12 education in this country. What's amazing to me is we have all this money to feed the for-profit monster. I mean, the numbers that you've laid out here that are going to these for-profit companies are double, sometimes triple, what we're spending on public universities for far less results and far less people.
Yeah, and you know, keep your eye on the Mother Jones website, because we're tracking this not only in the militaries and the for-profits, but like you said, in the public sector and secondary education. Actually, we've got a story upcoming about how former Governor Jeb Bush down in Florida is intimately involved in some privatization schemes of the school, public schools down there. You know, a lot of investors are seeing that there is big money to be had in here, because, frankly, it's another form of corporate welfare. It's coming straight from the taxpayers with great intentions, trying to, you know, help public school students, or in this case, veterans, and, you know, it ends up in the hands of a lot of investors.
You got to love Jeb Bush. Just started last week, just started his disaster management company to privatize, yep, to help privatize FEMA. Now, you know, Bush family got their hands in education with Neal's Ignite, and now you're pointing out Jeb's also involved there too. You know, the whole privatization scheme, I would say the Bush family has benefited quite handsomely.
Well, it's them and it's a whole lot of other folks. You know, I've been reporting out of Florida recently and Rick Scott kind of makes the Bush family look, Bush League when it comes to a lot of that stuff. You know, we've also got some stories up about how he's basically making, welfare recipients pay for their own urinalysis to be able to get their benefits.
From his wife's company.
Well, that's they ended up not going through that company, but that was one of the things that kind of held it up in the legislature before it went through. So, you know, this is just part of that larger, broader push from the Koch brothers in the Midwest to Wisconsin to, you know, here in the Beltway with a lot of these for-profit universities being able to lobby Congress and say, hey, you know, let us, you know, help these veterans. There's just this push to get that public money into private hands.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Adam Weinstein, national security reporter over at Mother Jones Magazine. The piece, again, is how pricey for-profit colleges target vets, GI Bill money. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Adam's name. It'll take you right there. You know, looking at these for-profit universities, how much... You know, I guess one of the questions I have is how reliant are these universities on public money? I mean, because, you know, the right loves to say how, you know, private is better and they're more efficient. But how much of their existence is dependent on me and you and on the rest of us as taxpayers?
You know, they're insanely reliant on public funding. And what's interesting is that the GI Bill, the military money that they're getting is a very small but kind of vital portion of that. There's a federal rule. You see, there's all the other, federal financial aid that the government has sort of extended to students. You've got your Pell Grants, you've got your Stafford loans, your PLUS loans. There's all kinds of ways that we try to help students finance their educations. And the thing is that those for-profit colleges are eligible for that as well, but they have to make sure that less than 90% of their total funding, of their total income, comes from the federal Department of Education loans. Funny thing is, the GI Bill doesn't count towards that. So the more GI Bill money they get, the more Department of Education money they can get without running afoul of any of the rules that Congress has set up. And that's it's called the 90-10 rule, and that's a huge loophole that a couple of Democratic senators are trying to tighten up in the foreseeable future.
Now, I wonder if that was just an oversight in the GI Bill, figuring that someone wouldn't notice, or if that was something heavily lobbied for.
Hard to say at this point. You know, it's a very arcane process. There doesn't seem to be anybody who's really willing to or able to step up and take full oversight of this. The Veterans Affairs Department kind of delegates a lot of its responsibilities to overseeing this, these for-profits and every other school that's eligible for VA loans, and GI Bill, to the state level. And a lot of that, you know, we've had GAO audits that just show that that's just not working out very well. But as you point out, there is lobbying. For-profits spent more than $7 million on lobbying Congress last year. So, you know, could be a variation of those factors.
No surprise there. You know, these are very slick operators. I mean, they know their business, and they know they're like any good used car salesman or any good snake oil salesman. They know the buzzwords. They know how to get people in. And as you point out in your pieces, there's a number of very interesting websites with very official sounding names like armedforcesedu.com or useyourgibill.us, things that may, you know, kind of mislead a little bit.
Yeah, and for this we have actually a couple of workers at the Department of Veterans Affairs to thank. They actually hired an Iraq vet named Alex Horton to be one of their bloggers. And Alex, along with his supervisor, Brandon Friedman, who also is an Iraq vet, you know, they got a solicitation from a quote-unquote reporter at GIBill.com. They said they never heard of it, and, you know, they work for the people that give out GI Bill, and they said, well, what is this? Started doing a little poking around on the Internet, and they found that it was created by basically, a corporate PR campaign that is funded by these for-profit universities. So if you are if you're a serviceman, servicewoman, you're coming back, you're trying to find out how do I use these benefits, how do I access them, you do a Google search, the first thing that comes up is a link that's sponsored by these for-profit universities, and it's going to steer you towards using your benefits at these for-profits. You might not even know that you have other options available to you.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, and it should be criminal, some of the things that are going on, some of the schemes that they're running, not just against soldiers, but also against the 9/11 families and people around that and the programs. To me, at some point, you got to look at this and say, this is just wrong.
Well, you know, it's anytime that kind of money gets involved in it and you've got to satisfy investors that are kind of divorced from the very function that you're supposed to serve, which is providing education to students, not consumers. Anytime you get involved in there, there's going to be some serious ethical issues. I want to believe that, you know, we don't have to tell veterans where to use their benefits and where to go to school just to help them make better informed choices and to be aware that these sorts of, you know, kind of scandalous, really unethical looking websites and practices are out there, and just, you know, kind of give them the information they need to be better informed and make more powerful choices. But, you know, it's an uphill climb.
Yeah. I looked at one of the websites you put in here from one of the guys who went to the University of Phoenix, the website ripoffreport.com, and he said that, you know, they treats the military students like cash pinatas. I think that pretty much sums it up.
Exactly. I mean, you know, you take your chances. Maybe everything goes right. Maybe, you know, that certificate in gun repair from, Capella or someplace is going to stand you in good stead. But in all likelihood, you are probably better served spending less money at the community college.
Yeah. Last question. Any statistics, any numbers on job placement, anything to show that there's value in these places?
You know, so far it's all anecdotal. We're actually looking forward to Senator Carper, Senator Harkin putting out some more numbers this week, and that may actually be part of what's in there. So far all we've been able to look at is the same abysmal numbers across the board for for-profit that you've seen. We haven't been able to see anything specifically for military veterans, but the anecdotal evidence is out there between the reporting we've done, recent Frontline, Bloomberg Business Week. There's just a whole lot of veterans out there who feel bamboozled, who find themselves in kind of a debt hole, thought they were getting help with their educations and their futures, and now they're kind of, you know, up the river without a paddle.
And in deep depth along with it. The piece is How Pricey For-Profit Colleges Target Vets, GI Bill Money. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Adam Weinstein, I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, can take a quick break. We are back right after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
President Obama has joined the perky posse of national leaders who are urging Americans to be more upbeat about the economic doldrums we're in. Shake off all the naysaying and the anxiety and the hand-wringing, he recently told us, sounding a lot like a football coach telling a player to shake off a concussion and get back in the game. The president's pep talk came the day after he made his bold jobs proposal to Congress. But Obama's plan is more Walter Mitty-ish than Rooseveltian. While it does have some useful provisions to keep from losing still more jobs, the core of Obama's plan consists of two more corporate tax breaks, a form of bribery to induce enormously rich corporations to hire American workers. This is the same old that Washington keeps throwing at the problem, and hello, Washington, it's not working. Sure enough, corporate chieftains say they'll gladly take the latest handout, but we should not expect them to go on a big hiring spree. Mostly, they'll use the money to cover the few people they were going to hire anyway, and pocket the rest. Nonetheless, Obama is now barnstorming the country, rallying crowds to demand that Congress, quote, stop the political circus and actually do something to help the economy by passing his plan. Fine, but what about the corporate circus and the Wall Street circus? It's time to stop coddling these gluttonous narcissists. America is in crisis, sinking toward depression. The president should really get bold by calling out and shaming corporate executives who suck up America's wealth, then turn their backs on us, as though the only loyalty they owe is to their own avarice, none to their country. Likewise, he should kick the bailed-out bankers right in their ample butts and insist publicly that they start making loans to America's smaller businesses that do want to create good jobs in our country. This is Jim Hightower saying, let's stop begging and start demanding.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick sent me an email with a link to this story from the Wall Street Journal. Again, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally and appreciate a story every now and again. But he sent me this Wall Street Journal article titled, Who Killed Private Pensions? And to be honest, I always thought it was a guy named Ted Benna who killed the private pension. He was the guy who is given credit with figuring out how to use the 401k, which is, you know, Section 401k of the IRS code. He's from Philadelphia, actually. He's the guy who figured, hey, we can use this. And then it just opened up and all hell broke loose and you could kiss the private pensions away and the defined benefit goodbye. But you know, they go in and they talk about a retiree who thought when he retired, he's going to retire with, you know, $50,000 a year. He's going to have health care. He's going to have all these things that he was promised all the years that he worked. So he gets to the end of the road. They say, okay, you're going to retire. Now instead of $50,000, he ends up with about $18,000 because now his health care has sucked up the rest of it. And what's gone on since the advent of the 401k, over the past, you know, 20, 25 years, you've seen companies cutting pensions. They're gutting health care retirement plans, and they're just basically slash and burn. And now, over the last several years, they're cutting 401ks as well. So the whole pension system that we had fought for, gone. And where's it gone? Well, it's gone into the pockets of the investor class. You know, they write, just over a decade ago, pension plans had $250 billion in surplus. Today, they're collectively underfunded by about 20%. Now, they're saying, the reality is we've had some losses because of the market, you know, the crash and all that. But they're also saying people didn't pay into it. And they looked at Verizon. Verizon, their predecessor, Bell Atlantic, what they had done is they had moved about $3 billion of its pension to incentives for people, their managers, to retire. So they had taken money out of the pension fund, said, okay, you middle management people, we're going to cut your positions. Here's a nice little goodbye. Incentive to get out the door. You know how it goes. And a lot of companies have done this. You know, they were shedding people, they're kicking people out the door and giving them these buyouts, but they're taking it from the future. Does it sound familiar? Any of this? And then they just pretty much stopped. Oh, we got all this money in the pension fund. The pension fund's 100% funded. Why should we have to put more in? It's 100%. Well, all of that money that you should have been putting all along in would have been the cushion against the blow that happened. Think state employee pension plans. You know, how many years was it, Jake? 15 years? They didn't add a dime?
About that.
Giving them the ability to go back to their people and say, look, we didn't raise taxes. And what's interesting is you go back, and this has been 30 years in the making. Remember the go-go 80s, all the mergers and the acquisitions, all of the corporate raiders who would come in and shift the pension money around? It was a nice scheme. I mean, it really was a nice scheme. What they would do is they would say, okay, Jake, you can buy XYZ portion of the company, and we'll move a whole bunch of pension assets over to you, and you pay us 70 cents on a dollar for those pension interests, and then you can do whatever it is you want to do with those, and we'll just take the 70 cents. So they sold it off, and their workers, well, they got screwed. But that's okay. That's okay. Because, you know, they're creating jobs. But what they were doing is they were destroying this country. And if you ever watched that movie, Other People's Money, to me, that was one of those, a perfect example of what happened to this country in about 2 hours. There was a company who was, you know, they were profitable, not wildly, but they were making their way in the world. They were making a reasonable profit. They were paying a little dividend to their shareholders, but they were employing people. Decent, living wages, good community jobs. They come in, we want the pension fund. That's it. You're cash heavy. You're worth more dead than you are alive to the investor class. They don't care about the workers. And in the 80s, they saw the pension fund as a big cookie jar to get their hands in. Oh, boy, we could divvy up these pension funds. Because they won't know it for 20, 30 years until we're gone. So the heist is over. And what they did, another masterful move. They created a crisis. So for 10 or 15 years here in the state, they didn't add any money into the pension fund. Creating a crisis. And now what are we talking about? Talking about not giving people their pensions up in Rhode Island. They're talking about cutting current retirees in half. You know, all of these people who, you know, for their lives, they thought, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to have this secure pension because I worked for it and I paid into it. And now we're turning around and telling, I'm sorry, in your golden years, we're going to have to cut your wages. Or that health care that we promised you, we're going to take that away. Basically, screw you. My CEO needs a new pair of shoes. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And the more of this that they're able to take back, the more they put into their pocket. And the Wall Street Journal points out employers' ability to generate profits by cutting retiree benefits coincide with the trend of tying executive pay to performance. They write, intentionally or not, top officers who green-lighted massive retiree cuts were indirectly boosting their own compensation. Intentionally or not, my backside. Intentionally. These are smart bank robbers. They know how to rip you off. And they've been doing it for 30 years. And the only people who would have stood in the way were the union people, who would question, where's my pension? These numbers don't add up, which is why we have to destroy unions, because we don't want anybody asking questions. We have to destroy employee representation because we don't want employees to know what's going on. We want to be able to do like we did in the 80s, steal all their money and leave before they know what happens, like thieves in the night. And that's what's going on. And now they're telling us, sorry, Joe, working class. Sorry, Miss Working Class. We got to tighten our belts. Shared sacrifice. Times are tough. You know, we really need your help. You need to kick in. But heaven forbid you talk about raising taxes on the rich. Oh, no. Because we need our billionaires. Leave no billionaire behind. That's my motto. If only we had. Really, I think we should start a campaign, Jake. We need to cross that 2,000 billionaire threshold. If we did that, all would be right with the universe. Would be.
Well, it would make my day, obviously.
Might even put hair on your head.
Yeah, well, let's not get carried away here.
But, I mean, really, I mean, when you look at this, and the president's plan is not all that outrageous. Let the Bush tax cuts expire. Go back to the way it was before Bush. Let it go back the way it was. Reduce some of the itemized deductions. Reduce some of the stuff that, you know, that people over $250,000 are taking. Maybe that third home. Maybe not let them deduct the third home. You know, close some of the loopholes. Close some of the, you know, the tax breaks for corporate jets. You know, eliminate all those tax breaks for the oil and gas industry. They don't need it. They're well established. Tax breaks are for fledgling industry that's just coming up. In fact, take that money from the oil and gas people, give it to the solar and the wind and the geothermal. Get that stuff up and running. And basically, take those accounting tricks out of the system. You know, this whole idea of last in, first out. This whole idea that, you know, whatever the price was, the last price, that's for all of it. And we get to reduce our costs and our taxable income by they're saying $72 billion over 5 years just in that one thing. And I'm sorry. I don't think, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know that my CEO needs to have a corporate jet. It's costing us about $3 billion over 10 years. You want to talk about that? Let's talk about that. But this is not class warfare. This is common sense. And like the president says, it's math. And I know there's probably going to be a war on math now. Because there's no war. There seems to be no logic on the right. Simple stuff, man. Simple stuff.
Well, I got to say, I, along with a lot of people, it was nothing but praise for the president.
A little late, but...
is it? I hope not. You and I think it's about time is maybe the right word, but I like some of his verbiage, you know, asking the wealthy to pay their fair share is not class warfare. It's simple math. Whoever came up with that, got to give him a lot of credit. And he also attacked John Boehner, if you remember. John Boehner was saying, class warfare is, and tit for tat is not going to win it. And the president came right back at him and said, no, Mr. Boehner, you're dead wrong. What you are doing is wrong. You know you got to step up to the plate. I'm paraphrasing here. You know you got to step up to the plate. You know, stop trying to BS the American public. And I was proud of him for that. It's about time. And his demeanor, he was actually, I don't know if he gets visibly angry, but he was very aggressive. And he was
the angry black man.
He was assertive, and that's great to see. I just hope he can continue that on.
Like the one commentator Fox had on, he's playing the angry black man. Are you kidding me? Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Ever check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. That'll find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
So the president has come out with the plan.
The plan. The Buffett rule.
The Buffett rule and the...
Yes.
But it's, you know, according to the Republicans, class warfare.
Yeah, it's a veto threat. No, it's just math.
To me, it's just math. I mean, to be honest, you look at the decline of the country, and I can make the argument it's the decline of the tax rates that have caused it.
Well, he says it's just math, but Republicans and then some Democrats, including Democratic strategist Mark Penn, who Tea Partiers have been quoting to me today. I never thought a day would come when the Tea Party was quoting Mark Penn to me, but they are, think he's making a huge mistake. But basically, the president is saying that this is a $3.2 trillion deficit reduction proposal. And, you know, one of the quotations was the speaker says, we can't have my way or the highway. And then says, and he did say this quite funnily, actually, I was in the Rose Garden. And then says, basically, my way or the highway.
Yeah.
That's not smart. It's not right.
You know, at the end of this, you know, I guess conventional wisdom on the right is that Obama has to move further to the center, and further to the center means no tax increases on the millionaires and billionaires. I'm hoping that maybe Obama's not taking that advice, and it appears not. And I guess part of this is kind of a billionaire's alternative minimum tax, saying, look, you need to pay something, right?
That is right. Now, one person said to me today, yes, but these people have already paid considerably more on their way up. So why should they be penalized twice?
Well, here's at the end of the day, you need roads, you need bridges, you need military, you need schools, you need all of these things. And who has the money?
Well, you got it's like, why do you rob banks?
Well,
which is probably the wrong analogy.
Well, the reason that people lately have been robbing banks is to pay their taxes and try and stay in their homes.
True.
As we've been seeing some stories lately. So what are the chances do you think this idea passing through?
Absolutely none.
Yeah. See, I didn't think so either, but it's nice to have that discussion, because I think you've got to prime people, and it's good to see the president coming out and going, look, you know, chances are it's never going to pass, but this is where we should be going. Taking a page out of the right wing's playbook, which is throwing out every wish list they've got. And then if they get 98% of it, like Boehner said they got, they're extremely happy.
The president knows that this is not necessarily going to go anywhere. I mean, this really is the president laying it out there. So what he's doing really, this is something to refer to in his re-election stump speech. This is his way of thumping Republican congressional candidates and whoever his opponent is for views on taxes and Medicare that poll test really badly.
Yeah. You know, I saw a poll today that said two out of ten people think that they're going to be millionaires at some point in their life. And, you know, I go, you know, that's not really a high number, but if you think about it, I think there's only about 8% of the population that are really millionaires. That's pretty optimistic for a good portion of the population. But then you think 80% don't. So, I mean, there's a lot of people in there where you could go, yeah, I mean, they should be paying their fair share.
Yes, exactly, exactly. No, people do feel that way. The polling is that people want a combination of tax cuts and of tax increases. And the proportion, it depends who you speak to. Some
Right.
people want more of one, some people want more of another, but they want a mixture. Republicans don't want any.
That's right. But, you know, it's all in the radical self-interest. I want spending cuts, just not my spending cuts.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So let's move along. Globally, UN Week is up and running, correct?
UN Week is happening. Last week was Fashion Week. This week is
UN
Week.
Yes. So now we're going to be talking about the Palestinians wanting their own place.
Yes, and they do. And Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, met with Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, today, and told him that he will be seeking Palestinian statehood on Friday, and Ban Ki-moon did not say, well, good luck with that then. He didn't say that, because, actually, he might have some good luck with that, depending how it goes. U.S. and European officials have been working frantically to try to head this off at the pass, not necessarily having any luck. It looks like this is going to go forward. The feeling by the U.S. is, the U.S. position is, look, the best way for the Palestinians to get statehood is through the two-state solution,
right,
through direct negotiations. Doing this is just going to, A, tick off Israel more. B, it's not going to be real statehood. All that's going to happen is it's going to say that they've got statehood, but really they're going to go back home and they will still have
nothing.
Checkpoints.
Yep.
They will still have poverty. They won't have food. Nothing will have changed.
We've got
nothing,
this golden
nothing.
Ticket. We've got this golden ticket. I just have no one to validate.
Exactly. Exactly.
And, you know, I mean, this whole thing with going back to the 67 borders, I know Obama was taking some heat over this. Where's this plan?
Obama is taking quite a bit of heat over this because some people are saying that he hasn't been strong enough in trying to speak against Palestinians. In fact, his people have been working on this for some considerable time. Really, what the administration's mistake has been, if they have made a mistake, is that as with their other foreign policy issues, they haven't touted what they've been doing. Of course, he did also say that the Palestinians should have statehood and it would be nice to have it at the UN, and that, you know, is coming back to haunt him. Yeah. But he has been very strong in this. He's also said that the U.S. will veto this in the Security Council if it comes up. But what they are trying to do is to get 9 votes. That's the number that they need. They're trying to get 9 votes so that they can defeat it that way. They don't know if they have them.
Interesting. Well, we'll see where this goes. Tomorrow, big day for the LGBT community.
Yes. Don't ask, don't tell is over officially.
No chance of going back on that last minute, 11th hour. Hey, we kind of changed your mind. This is actually going to happen.
I think it's actually going to happen. I really think it's really, really over.
So now will the military roll out pink uniforms or anything? Anything special to commemorate?
Yes, it's all going to be pink.
Nice.
Except the Navy's going to be mauve.
Yeah, because I have some friends they're just incensed, absolutely incensed. And I'm like, well, do you think they're going to come out with skimpy outfits and the YMCA type outfits? Do you think that's really going to happen?
Yeah.
And some of them do. Some of them do. So, good times ahead. Lastly, Texas is going through here in Pennsylvania, going through the redistricting process. Is it legal?
Well, the Department of Justice says no. In fact, it says heck no. What's going on is that there's been some growth in Texas, and the growth has been largely due to the Latino population, a large surge, actually, and that's almost entirely responsible for Texas being awarded 4 additional House seats, more than any other state. But the surprise, surprise here is that the way that the new congressional map of Texas has been redrawn, they don't think that they're going to get more than 1 seat, if that. And they've gone about getting this sorted out in a very complicated way. They're not going straight to the Justice Department because they think they'll get shot down. They're going to a particular type of court in Washington, D.C. But anyway, the DOJ today declared in federal district court that the redistricting plan approved by the government of Texas is illegal, setting the stage for a legal showdown to determine how Texas will select its representatives. And they say it does not maintain or increase the ability of minority voters to elect their candidate of choice. This will almost certainly go to the Supreme Court.
Well, that'll be interesting considering that they're mostly a conservative court. And, we'll see. Are there any, Rorschach tests on the layout? Because I always love how like here in Pennsylvania, there's one that on the state side that is just obscene looking. I mean, it's all over the place. It looks like they carved out blocks instead of neighborhoods. They carved out a couple of houses. I mean, it's amazing at how they drew this thing up.
I know. Sometimes they really just look like, how did that happen?
Not by accident, I'll tell you that. Not by accident, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. Good news. Victoria, I appreciate the time. Always great talking to you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
All righty, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Now to find out what we've got going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jay?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Big story coming out of Harrisburg. This computer gate fiasco is coming down pretty close to the trial. The trial for former Representative Brent Feese of Muncie, Brian Presky of Philadelphia, and ex-chief of staff to former House Speaker John Purcell and longtime Feese aide John Seaman of Dauphin is scheduled to begin next week. Feese, Presky, and Seaman are accused of participating in a conspiracy to use state-funded computer services to forward GOP political agendas. Purcell and several other defendants have pleaded guilty to charges in this case and are expected to be called by the state attorney general's office to testify against the others. Here's the irony. The irony here is that House Speaker Purcell was the big fish in the scandal. He's copped a plea for a lesser sentence in return for testimony against the other defendants. He, in fact, was the mastermind behind using public funds to enhance his career by going after his political adversaries, both in the Democratic and the Republican Party. It seems in this case, Rick, that politics makes strange bedfellows.
You know what would be funny? It'll be hysterical if those people that he testifies against, him being the mastermind, the ringleader, it'll be hysterical if they get more time than he gets. I will laugh hysterically.
Well, we shall see. That could happen. That could happen. But, you know, here's the thing. We're assuming that these others are going to be adjudged guilty. There have been several already that have gotten off, and they've been adjudged innocent. So we shall see. It's ugly, ugly, ugly. FEMA Center in Lendon County, I think of all the counties, outside of maybe Dauphin, Lendon probably got hit the hardest. I know in my neighborhoods it was horrendous. But I have to say this, FEMA, my Congressman Holden, Senator Casey have been on top of that. The next day they were in our communities. They were setting up meetings, and now apparently there's been a disaster center that has been opened up at the Lendon Valley Mall, Lendon, by FEMA. Near the former KB Toy Center. The center will be open from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. for as long as it's needed. Residents can apply for low-interest loans and grants for damages caused by Tropical Storm Lee. Also, Lendon County is offering a $500 grant on first-come, first-served basis to storm victims who meet income guidelines and provide proof of their losses. Applications can be made starting at 8:30 a.m. in the Lebanon Municipal Building. The program, which uses the County Affordable Housing Program funds, will end when 2,000 grants are issued, according to County Commissioner Litz. So far, I have to say the county government and the federal government have done a pretty good job. Here's a good story. Maybe you'll want to take advantage of this, Rick. Union Plus is offering a prepaid credit card. The consumer benefits arm of the AFL-CIO is helping union members make the most of their savings while avoiding hidden fees with their new Union Plus Visa card. For union members with a checking or savings account, the Union Plus prepaid card does not charge for insufficient funds or overdraft fees. It also offers a savings account featuring an annual percentage yield, and listen to this, of 5.10% on account balances compared to about 0.15% nationally. That's a good deal. The Union Plus prepaid card features these things: no activation fees or monthly minimums, savings account with a 5.10% interest rate, no fee for using the card for purchases, manage money by phone, mobile phone, email, and the internet. It's easy to reload at 50,000 locations, FDIC insured up to 250,000, and all customer support calls answered in the United States. You can visit this online, and this is one word, myunionprepaid.com. That's myunionprepaid.com. I have to say, it looks like a good deal, that 5.10. I think I might look into that.
There you go. And you said that they don't charge overdraft fees?
That's correct.
Do they charge late fees?
I don't believe.
See, because I would say if they don't, that's your card because you're forever late.
It says insufficient funds or overdraft fees.
And did you get anything for that promo?
No, I didn't.
Well, what's wrong with you? That's what you're supposed to be doing.
Nice
commercial. Good job.
I'm actually going to look into that.
There you go.
One last story, Rick. For 6 months, the grocery employees.
How long?
6 months. For 6 months, the grocery employees have been fighting a battle out in California against Vons Incorporated, Ralph's Grocery Company, which is a subsidiary of Kroger, and Albertson, which is owned by Super Value. A ratification vote is scheduled for later this week. The grocery employees are members of the United Food Commercial Workers, the L.A. Federation of Labor is instrumental in keeping that in the eye of the public. It had a lot of demonstrations. Thousands of union members helped out, and it looks like they've come up with a contract, and that takes guts today.
Yeah. How long was it?
6 months.
All righty. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up.
Freeway ride. They slashed our funding, they cut all our hours,
by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, with everyone yelling at me. When did I become the problem? How did the fault become all mine? The president says, tightening their belt, the only one to tighten is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Lots there to see, do, and in case you missed any of the program, right there, video, audio, right there for your enjoyment, entertainment. Also, smartphone, if you have one, the Stitcher app, take the program on the go wherever you are. You'll have it with you. Good stuff. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. A couple of quick things. The PETA people, who generally I think are nuts, protesting on Monday, they have asked for a federal probe into the deaths of two bisons. The bison were at Zoo America in Hershey. You'll remember this, and I got to be honest, I'm kind of with them on this. PETA's usually on the crazy side. But they do have a point here. They're saying that the flooding came up on September 7th, resulted in one of the bison, a bison named Esther, she drowned. And the other bison, named Ryan, they shot. Because, you know, the water was rising, and they didn't want poor Ryan to drown as Esther had, so they shot him. And the thing is, you know, the PETA people are saying, hey, look, you knew this was coming. You knew that, you know, we were going to have this. Why couldn't you get them to a safe place? Which I think it's got a reasonable thought because, you know, again, one of these moments, if you're going to be a zoo, you got to have an evacuation plan. And in fact, it's being investigated by the Association of zoos and aquariums, which I guess I didn't know you had to have an accreditation to be a zoo, but I guess they're the ones who are the accreditation agency for Zoo America. But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, Pete's got a point here, and I would be interested to see what comes out of it because you need to have plans. And understand that this was a once-in-a-really-long-time kind of thing, but that's why you have emergency evacuation plans. You know, Tom Corbett's on the airwaves all the time saying, you know, if you're old, you should have a plan. Well, you know what? If you're in charge of other people or animals, you should have a plan. Pretty simple. So I agree with PETA on that. So, as I said, generally crazy, generally kind of out on the thing, and they did not disappoint today. Evidently, you know, as Reuters reported, PETA is now, and I'm not quite getting the sense of this. Maybe I may join PETA now, because you know, generally they're younger women, pretty good looking. Some that I've met an aversion to bathing, but you know, that's a whole different scenario. You can push them in the river or something with that. Evidently, they are now, and I'm not making this up, they are going to start a pornography website in the name of animal rights. Reuters report the nonprofit organization, whose controversial campaigns draw criticism from women's rights groups, said it hoped to raise awareness of veganism through a mixture of pornography and graphic footage of animals suffering. One of the associate directors of campaigns said, we're hoping to reach a whole new audience of people, some who will be shocked by graphic images that maybe they didn't anticipate seeing when they went to PETA's XXX site. I really don't know where to go with this. I'm scared. You don't mix people's porn with animal rights. Here's what really, really frightens me. You know, they say serial killers, they start off by killing little animals, and then they work their way up. And there's also a tie-in with pornography. There's part of me that goes, you're going to get people aroused and excited by mostly men. Young teenage men, maybe of all ages, really, because who doesn't enjoy a good porn site, Jake? So you're going to put all these images that are arousing and, you know, doing something to the brain, and then you're going to throw torture of animals into that? Are you not now sending a really screwed up mixed message and maybe traumatizing someone to now finding torturing animals to be semi-erotic? And, you know, I'm making kind of light of this, but there's a serious undertone here. Are you now, are you going to put those kind of erotic images that are meant to, you know, to stimulate, you know, next to torturing animals? That scares me. It's nuts. So tell Pete enough. Okay, you made your point. Stop it. Leave the porn people alone. And I wonder if it's going to be the PETA people. I think we should get someone from PETA. We should try. We're going to try and get someone from PETA because I really need to know. And lastly, I need to know why Kate from Kate and Eight. Or
I saw that.
Why she was doing 88 with Kate. And was she on a roller skate? Sound like Dr. Seuss now.
No, she was a 222.
Well, that doesn't rhyme.
Okay.
Now I guess the speed limit was 65. She was doing 100. She was doing 88. Just a mere 23 miles over the speed limit. I guess I can't say anything. I have been known to put my foot down, especially at 1:30 in the morning. And I read some of the comments. Why is she out there endangering other people? It's 1:30 in the morning. There's nobody else around. But evidently she was in a hurry to get home with her children, which is what she said. And I got to be honest, stop it with the children, honey. Leave the children alone. Stop using them. Stop exploiting them. Stop blaming them. You were in a hurry to get home. Be honest. Want to get home. The children were in bed. Say, I didn't want to pay a babysitter anymore. I needed that extra buck and a half. because my show is no longer on TV and I need to conserve because I don't want to go back to being a nurse. That I buy. But, you know, this whole thing, my children, not getting it. So there you go, Kate at 88. Anyway, hope you had a great time tonight. We'll see you back here tomorrow. See you then.
It's coming from the wind.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.